brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. It turns out Harrisburg's got the gun show back. Yes, guns back. NRA in charge running the show. And we also have a giant mom apple pie baseball assault weapons billboard to show for it. And guess what? Surprise, surprise. Another school shooting, this one at Purdue University. No one knows why at this point, and really that's about all I'm willing to say about it. Another insane shooting. But the guns don't do it. No. Guns don't kill people. People do. But, you know, as I've always said, the gun helps. Also going to talk about electric choice. If you don't choose, we'll do it for you. Which kind of blows my mind. I thought it was about choice. So if I don't choose, you're going to choose for me. That's the way I'm seeing it. So we'll talk about that. Also, the Pennsylvania Republican Party pushing crazy on all fronts. I think now that they realize they're in real deep trouble, it's, hey, let's go as crazy as we can. Let's throw all of the insanity out there, embolden the wackadoodles and see where the chips lie. Scary, scary stuff in the next several months. Also, a new report out by Oxfam titled Working for the Few, where they find out that there are 85 people in this world who control more wealth than half of the population of our world. And no, we don't have an inequality problem. Look the other way. Also going to talk about news from Cambodia as labor strife. I guess strife isn't a strong enough word. Unrest, not a strong enough word. These are people who are demanding a decent living. And you know what? The government is now pushing back, shooting people in the streets. We'll talk about that. And also some privatization news. Privatization, all that, and much, much more. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments, whatever's on your mind. Something popped in there, let me know. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So some of the big news today, one of the big stories, former Virginia Governor Bob McDonald. Yes. Bob McDonald, you may remember Bob got himself into trouble last year, I'm pretty sure it was, where it turned out that he was accused of taking some $120,000 worth of stuff from this millionaire guy. And if you remember the whole to-do, he paid it back with interest, made a big to-do about it, had a big, you know, one of those press conferences where, you know, I'm embarrassed, it's an embarrassment to the state, and, you know, but I've done nothing wrong, but we're paying it back, but I've done nothing wrong. I deeply regret accepting legal gifts and loans from Mr. Williams, all of which have been repaid with interest. And I have apologized for my poor judgment, which I take full responsibility. However, he repeated emphatically that he did nothing illegal. If you did nothing wrong, if you did nothing, why'd you pay it back? And I often wondered, and as I was watching this all unfold last year, I go, you know, if I walk into a bank and I rob a bank, but then I go back and say, oh, I didn't mean it. Here's the money back. Do I still go to jail? We shall see. Because here's the reality. The indictment came down, 14 charges each for the former governor and his wife. The indictment alleges that the couple accepted more than $135,000 in very expensive clothing, trips here and there on the private jet, loans, and, you know, some other stuff from this Johnny Williams Sr., the former CEO of Star Scientific. They're I guess, a one of those dietary supplement companies. I guess there's a lot of money in that stuff. He goes on to say that he will fight it. He'll fight the false allegations. The government's overreaching, and the facts are clearly on his side, and he's going to use every bit of pull that he's got to go after and face these things because, you know, blah, 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 blah. Now, this is a guy people were thinking about maybe possible presidential candidate in 2016. He has been officially charged with wire fraud, conspiracy, and obtaining property under the color of official offices. Now you go through and you look at the stuff, and then the wife's It's kind of the same thing. Also false statements on the financial form. Something else. Now you look at this and you look at the stuff that just obnoxious. You know, you go through the indictment details a number of trips that they took on this Johnny Williams jet, private dinners at the governor's mansion with Johnny Boy. Got to suck in some of that money. A 2011 shopping trip to New York. Hey, you know, Mama needs a new pair of shoes. She went and bought herself some Oscar de la Renta, some Louis Vuitton, and some other stuff that I can't even pronounce, let alone want to wear. Evidently bought the daughter a wedding dress, paid for an anniversary party. You know, being a politician, you know, got to be a nice gig. Parties galore. Now, according to the indictment, the quid pro quo in this is, you know, I guess Mama got Mr. Williams a seat right next to the governor at some event. I hope there's more than that. Because it seems to me that the numbers of this, and look, our political system is so corrupt. It's so badly broken. It's so flooded with corporate campaign wealth class cash that it's ridiculous. And I point to this article in the New York Times. I think it was day before yesterday, talking about this loophole. Because if you remember, you go back and you remember Bob Ney and Tom DeLay and what's his name, Jack Abramoff, that whole scandal with the Indian tribes and the golf trips to Scotland and all these things, all of these lobbyists giving gifts to these lawmakers. They passed a law that you can't do that. Which, you know, I'm in favor of. You shouldn't be giving gifts to the people who are supposed to be making our policy. You shouldn't be allowed to do that. Well, as is anything, when you make one law, they come up with another way of doing it. And what they've been doing is having these fundraisers. So they'll have fundraisers all over the country, and sometimes out of the country. But it's whatever, you know, you go to the Beverly Hills Hilton, you go to, you know, the ski in the Rocky Mountains, go to Utah and ski, you know, Park City, go all over the, and all of the top places in the country. All over to get your little bit of whatever. And it's not just Republicans, it's both Republicans and Democrats who, this is how they're going to do fundraisers. And as the article went into, it went through a bunch of representatives who, and we know this story. We've seen this story time and time again where, you know, the lobbyists, they get this special access because they've got the couple of bucks that it takes to get personal time with our legislators. And the thing that gets me is it's so little money. And that's what's frustrating. It's such a small amount of money, like $1,000 or $5,000, but you get 100, 200 of these lobbyists who kick this money to these politicians. They get free vacation. They get to go skiing. They get to do whatever they want. And it's off the books. And, you know, I look at this and I go, at some point, you know, we've got to realize that our system's seriously, seriously broken. And the money that is polluting our politics is screwing this country up something fierce. And it's frustrating on so many levels. So I look at this McDonald thing, and while it's distasteful, and I hope they got more than just the guy got to sit next to the governor at some event. I hope there's more. Because you look at all the stuff that all the rest of them are getting away with, that seems very, 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 very mild. Anyway, let's go to the phones real quick. I got James on line one. How are you doing tonight, James?
Been a while.
What's the good news?
Not much. I can imagine that I'm surprised you didn't know you missed if you're not talking about it tonight.
Well, I'm trying to get a guest on it. And what we're talking about is the Supreme Court's hearing a case that is going to screw home health care workers. I'm hoping I'm wrong, but I think it's going to be one of those deals where the Supreme Court says that they can't be union members. It's my view. But I'm trying to get people who are close to the case to come out and talk about it with a little bit better authority than I'm able to do.
All right. All righty then. As I said, I'm sure that through Facebook or Twitter or something, I'll be able to stay posted. And also, I will let you know that all I'm going to say is Tuesdays and Wednesdays are my days off.
There you go.
So I will be at the state capitol on Tuesday.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it.
With a camera that I don't think you've ever seen.
Oh, good.
I got a new so I'll be able to do some more photography. Well, as I said, I'll make sure that I keep my eyes and ears peeled, see if you can get anybody closer to that. But what I wanted to say is I could see that being used, and I'm sure that it's done now, would be to basically start using contract employees to kind of basically create a almost like a subclass.
Well, I would argue that the people that are in this situation are already a subclass.
No, but what I mean is that, you know, basically somebody will say, the gist of it I got is that, you know, basically they are organizing. They're organizing because they see themselves, or for the state of Illinois, they're state employees.
Right, and this is already done. The state of Illinois already recognizes them as state employees, and the concept behind it is that if you're taking care of an elderly relative, a disabled relative, spouse, somebody, that it's cheaper for you to take care of them in their home than it is to put them in a group home
or hire them.
And we know that to be the case. So what's gone on is they've organized all of these home health care workers, and they've said, you know what, it's cheaper for us to pay you to stay home and take care of your loved one than to put them in an institution. And by the way, you should have some basic employee rights, a decent wage, some health care, those kind of things to make sure that we're not exploiting them. And I'm all in favor of that, and I think it's a smart thing to do, and I think it's the right thing to do.
All right, as I said, I'll leave you to. I didn't mean to interrupt your program.
No, this is why we're here, James. Call anytime, call often. You've got something on your mind, we want to hear it.
All righty, Ben. You know I will.
I appreciate it.
I'll make an effort to. All righty,
bye-bye. I appreciate it. And that's for all of our listeners. The idea is, you know, this is about having that conversation, talking about important issues. I would love to hear people's ideas on how we get campaign cash out of our politics. I would love to hear people's ideas on how we make sure that people can stay in their homes with dignity and we take care of the people who are taking care of them. It's ludicrous to me. And I look at this case. This is a handful of people. A handful of people who say, well, we don't want to have to pay dues. Set up, I guarantee you, bottom line, set up by the National Right to Work Foundation, who said, oh, we've got these handful of people over here that we're going to put a monkey wrench in the whole system, and we're going to end up screwing thousands of families for our ideology and our personal nonsensical beliefs. That's what it's all going to be about. And I'm going to be interested to find out what the Supreme Court has to say. And in the coming days and weeks, we're going to go and I was looking for someone today who was close to the case, who would come and talk to us. We're in the process of doing that. Monday, I understand, I've got someone lined up, and that'll be when we get into it. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Local Teamsters Union officials are taking a look at details of a restructuring agreement the union says will save more than 30,000 good American jobs. The Teamsters reached a tentative agreement with YRC Worldwide that, quote, provides a pathway for substantial debt reduction and refinancing initiatives, end quote, that the Teamsters say will permit the company to protect and preserve the jobs. An initial company offer was rejected January 9th in a vote by over 19,000 Teamsters members. If the Committee of Local Teamsters officials approve, the tentative agreement will be sent on then to the membership for a ratification vote. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says the union pushed to reengage all stakeholders
in YRC Worldwide to come up with an alternative solution that protects jobs. Wisconsin is marking the fourth anniversary of the Citizens United U.S. Supreme Court decision with a rally and press conference calling on the Wisconsin legislature to debate a resolution that would put the Citizens United question to the voters of Wisconsin in a statewide referendum. A Wisconsin coalition is backing the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. They want Wisconsin to join 16 other states and over 500 communities nationwide that are calling for a constitutional amendment overturning the decision that allows corporations unlimited spending in elections. Congressional Republicans continue to hold jobless Americans hostage to other demands they're making before they will agree to extend unemployment benefits, and the suffering of people who have been unemployed for a long time continues. Workers recently delivered petitions to GOP congressional leaders in Washington urging that the benefits be extended. On a recent press conference call organized by Americans United for Change, Candace Hemmerly, a Wisconsin worker unemployed for more than 6 months, tearfully called on Congress to extend the benefits.
I've depleted my retirement to keep my son in college. I have not had the courage to tell him that I'm out of work. I began collecting, I began collecting my unemployment in June, and it ended last week. I have no more unemployment. I was struggling to get by on the $363 a week I received each week, but I made it, barely. I implore Congress to renew the federal unemployment insurance just to keep a roof over my head.
Alaska Airlines flight attendants are voting until February 14th on a new contract. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the new proposed deal includes top-of-the-industry improvements in many categories. 3,100 Alaska Airlines flight attendants are eligible to vote on the proposed new contract. The tentative agreement was reached between the union and Alaska Airlines with the help of the National Mediation Board.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor, and I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Tell you, that's one of us that's glad he's running for governor. You look at these last couple of years and you look at the direction, the priorities that this governor has pursued, and you've got a question: whose governor is he? I mean, on what side of this fence is he on? You look at what he's done to education. You look at what, right down the list, Act 13, the voter suppression law. You go right down the list of all of these horrible things for our state. And then that transportation bill that was, even according to his commission, not even nearly enough. And you got to ask, are we heading in the right direction? Which is why I'm glad to see that there are so many people with so many great ideas running on the Democratic side of the aisle for the governor's position. And we've got one of the candidates here. Tom Wolf is one of the Democratic gubernatorial candidates. WolfForPA.com is his campaign website. Tom, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rick. It's good to be here.
You know, I look at last Friday, for instance, our governor went to a public high school in Philadelphia for the very first time as governor, and then bails last minute. And, you know, I got to be honest, I wasn't surprised that he bailed. I was surprised that he was going to go there at all.
Well, I was surprised. Actually, as I said at the time, I was stunned. It was surprising that it took him that long to go visit a school, but he bailed, and that act of cowardice was surprising because, I mean, this was the consequence of his education policy. He evidently believed enough in that policy to promote it and get it passed. And the consequence was that there were a lot of unhappy people and people like me who disagree with that policy. But it was his policy, and you would have thought that he would have at least had the confidence to go and defend it, stand up for it, even though in that particular place, admittedly, it was unpopular, but that was surprising to me. I was actually surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised that he actually said he was going to go there in the first place. Considering that if you look before Governor Corbett took office, You know, this school had like 145 full-time staff. It had counselors. It had secretaries. Had a librarian. You know, I know schools, it's a luxury to have a librarian these days. After this governor, this budget year, down to 112 full-time staff. No non-teaching assistants, no librarians, the money for books and for extracurriculars all slashed. And you go, where's the priority? Where's the vision for the future?
Yeah, I'm, it's the vision for the future is the priority, but I think it's just the lack of appreciation for what public education actually is. The reason we all pay into public education is because it's a public good. I live in York County. My two daughters went to our local public school, and I really cared about the education they got, and they got a great education in the public school in our locality. But I also care, because I'm a citizen who pays taxes into the system, I also care about the education the kids in Philadelphia get, and the kids in Erie, Allegheny County, Reading. And the parents and the taxpayers in all of those localities should care about the education my daughters get. That's why it's called public education, because we all share the responsibility for sustaining it, because we all share in the benefits if it works out. And we all share in the consequences if we don't do a good job there. And I think the consequences is what we're seeing by not doing a good job in some of the areas that we're underserving in our public school system.
Yeah, the $400 million prison they're building in Philadelphia, while they've got a school district $300 million underfunded.
Yeah, that's the misplaced priorities.
So what does Governor Wolf do?
Well, there are a number of things. The first thing is to stand up, and I think I don't want to overstate this, but I've said this before. One of the things a governor should do is lead, and one of the ways you lead is stand up and reaffirm publicly and proclaim the reason, what I just said, why public education is important. It's not a private good. It's not a consumer good to which I should be indifferent, aside from the choice I'm making for my daughters. Of course, I have a special affection for my daughters, and I want to make the right decision. But I also benefit from good decisions that are made on behalf of every child in Pennsylvania. That's what public education is, and I would, among other things, stand up and proclaim that. Reaffirm, make sure that we all understand what public education is supposed to be. Rededicate ourselves to that idea that we share in this responsibility. That's the first thing. Second thing I would do is make sure that we restore the funding cuts that this governor put into place. And I know you can't throw money at education problems, and that's not the end-all be-all, but you can't starve it of funds either.
Right.
So we need to get back, bring back $1 billion, and we need to figure out what it is we need to actually invest in public education to make sure all of us Pennsylvanians are getting the right return on that investment. And a costing out study was done back in 2008, I think it was. And it was a bipartisan effort, and it said that it came up with a figure that we should be spending on public education. And in the Rendell administration, Governor Rendell started to move toward full funding of that funding formula. Again, with the understanding that we need to do things to you know, we can improve in some of the schools. We can. There's always room for improvement in every human endeavor.
Correct.
But we've got to start with an understanding that is going to take some commitment of funding. So I would restore the cuts and try to move us back toward the proper investment, whatever that is, in a public education.
Let me ask you this: the governor came out with his 73-page energy plan, which is basically, as I understand it, just in having seen it very briefly, just kind of like a yellow pages of programs that the state offers and energy programs that are out there. And his view is this is what's going to help attract business and create jobs. Fundamentally, I think I disagree. I think you need to have good infrastructure, good education, those things, along with a sane and rational regulatory and tax code. But I'm not seeing what he's doing as moving us in the direction that's going to attract jobs. Just handing out free money doesn't seem to work.
Yeah, that's bribery. I am a business person. I've built a business actually twice, a very successful business headquartered in Pennsylvania, created hundreds of jobs, and including good manufacturing jobs. I think I have as good a sense of what it takes to attract job creators and create a system that is conducive to job creation. And I agree with you. It's really about infrastructure. It's really about how we connect different regions of the state together. It's how we educate our children, how we invest in education and how productive that, that investment is. It's how level the playing field is when it comes to taxes and regulations across the board. Those are the kinds of things that, that make a place, that set the table for real job creation. It's not this Mickey Mouse bribery stuff that that I think he's so enthralled with. I think we need to get back to basics. We need to do what government should do, those few things it should do. We should do very, very well. And the things you mentioned, I agree with. That's what we should be spending our time and focusing our energies, making priorities, and getting this state back to where it should be as a driver of economic development, you know, magnet for entrepreneurs, and a creator of great jobs.
You know, as a business leader, as someone who, as you've said, has created jobs and has an understanding of it, I've talked to a number of location specialists who work for businesses to relocate or to locate to a new area, and they tell me that it's location, 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 which Pennsylvania has in spades, and then it's education and infrastructure. It's not these insane schemes to deny workers their rights. It's not these insane schemes to shift tax burdens from corporate interest to the taxpayers. It's none of those things. It's about location, 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 and education and infrastructure.
It is, and thank you for mentioning. You also mentioned the fair treatment of your employees. I don't know any successful business that has become successful by being indifferent to its workers. My employees get good wages, good benefits, and on top of that, I share 20 to 30% of my net profit each year in a cash distribution to all employees. And I do that because fairness actually works. It makes my truck drivers consider my customers are not just my customers, they're their customers. And the products that my warehouse people are packing into those trucks are not just my products, they're their products. I mean, sharing prosperity works in business. Shared prosperity works in a broad economy, and treating workers fairly is absolutely essential to success.
So you're not in favor of, and there are a bunch of pieces of legislation bing banging around in our legislature right now, trying to deny workers on the state level to have the state collect their dues, which seems really just insane under the guise of that it's so expensive, or we see this insane right to work nonsense popping up. So those, in your view, not the way we create jobs?
Absolutely not. I mean, what is this right to work? I mean, I didn't vote for Governor Corbett. I know that'll come as a shock to you. So does that relieve me of the obligation to pay taxes? I don't think so. Does it relieve me of the ability to take advantage of whatever public goods are out there, ride on the highways? No. So I'm not sure why that same logic, if I can't get a free ride in the public sector here, I'm not sure where the logic is coming from to say that when it comes to labor organizers, they get a majority of the vote. The majority of the workers in a particular plant say, you know, we think we need, or companies say we need to be represented. If the majority says that, why is that not legitimate in that setting where it is legitimate in, you know, politics? I don't get that. So yeah, I'm against right to work and when it comes to deducting dues. Most companies in at least my area deduct contributions to the United Way. What's the difference?
No, I
do that because it's right. It's fair.
I'm with you. And it's something that you negotiated. You know, as a business leader, it would blow my mind to say, okay, we're going to take this one negotiating tool away from you. You can't have this. Because that's usually one of the first things you sit down and negotiate.
Yeah, that would be wrong. And I wrote a piece, by the way, in the Daily Coast to actually try to get people to co-sign petitions for Pennsylvania and other states that are fighting against this nonsense.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Tom Wolf, Democratic gubernatorial candidate. His website, wolf4pa.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Tom's name. It'll take you right there. You know, and looking at what's going on in Harrisburg right now as governor, how do you deal with the political divide? I mean, we've got, honestly and truthfully, we've got a Republican Party that's kind of split down the middle. You've got maybe some sane, rational ones, and then you've got some, oh, my goodness, these are some crazy people.
Yeah, I think there are. I think it's in my business, if you see something you don't like, typically your first instinct is to look at the system. And I think there are a lot of good people in Harrisburg, in both parties. I think they're all trapped in a very bad system. And I think some of the things that this current administration is trying to do is just making that bad system even worse. So I've had a lot of success in very diverse situations. I was in the Peace Corps. I was an academic for a time. I've been most of my adult life as a business owner. I was actually even Secretary of Revenue. So I've been in very, very different situations trying to get people to do different things, go places they didn't necessarily think they wanted to go, and have had success doing that. And I think the right leader, the right leadership, the right approach in Harrisburg I think I could be just as successful there as I have in all my other endeavors.
You know, you brought up being Secretary of Revenue, and I know a couple of people who, you know, who work in the department who told me, and maybe this is true, maybe it's not, you can confirm it or deny it, that when you took over, you met with each and every person in that department.
Yeah, I did, and I did that because I got there, and it was a new experience for me. I had every other situation I'd been in, like my business, I started out from the bottom, at the bottom. I worked my way up into the company before I bought it, so I was a forklift operator, truck driver. I even managed one of our hardware stores. So I had a sense of what our products were, who our customers were. I think I knew when I got to revenue as Secretary of Revenue, there were 2,300 employees, and I wasn't really clear on what they did, and they were the experts. So I said, I need to visit each of these employees, and so I did. It took me 13 months between the lottery, which is in revenue, and the revenue offices around the state. I think I visited over 20 locations in that 13-month period, and I spoke in small groups or individuals with each employee, and unless they were on vacation, I mean, it's possible I didn't meet with everybody. It might have been sick, it might have been on vacation. But I really made an effort to understand what they did, what tools they used, what could make their jobs more fulfilling, better, how could they be better customer servants to the taxpayers in Pennsylvania. And when I came back, took that and turned it into, I think, a really good plan for modernization. And it was a plan that was good because it was based on the ideas and experiences and knowledge and expertise of the people who were on the front line,
and that's
the employees of the department. So that was a very self-serving thing I did. I don't want to, you know, take credit for doing something that was, it was, maybe that's, you know, I'm happy that you think that was a noble thing to do, but it was also a very important, I mean, it's the practicality of fairness. You ask somebody what they do, why they do it, what could make their job better, that actually makes for a better Department of Revenue. That's what I found.
Yeah, but oddly enough, in my conversations with folks, they hadn't had that in the past, and that's why they speak so highly of you. Last line of questioning I've got for you, you know, as former Secretary of the Department of Revenue, in charge of the lottery, I look at the last couple of years, our governor was trying to sell off the management of our lottery. In fact, spent a whole boatload of money that they claim we don't have because we can't invest in education or health care or any of those other things. Do we privatize the lottery system? Does it make any sense from a business perspective? And if not the lottery, how about the wine and spirit shops or any of the privatization schemes we've seen?
No.
That was easy.
I mean, really? There are two questions. I mean, there is a, can you improve? You can improve, as I said earlier, you can improve anything. We can make things better. When I was Secretary of Revenue, worked very closely with the employees, leadership at the lottery, and I think we worked hard together, and we made it better. Part of the profitability of the lottery, and it makes over $1 billion net profit today on $3 billion of sales, which is a huge net profit percentage. I mean, anybody in the private sector would just love to have a return like that. I'm not sure how you can, you know, you can you make it better? Yeah, we made it better, and I'm sure there's things we could do to continue to improve it, but privatization is not an end, and it, you know, you can make things better in the public sector. I think we did a good job, and I think all the $1 billion every year that comes for senior citizens is a wonderful thing. Why would you give that away? And I pardon me for, you know, correcting you. He's not selling it. He's essentially giving it away.
Yeah. Well, no, you're absolutely right. It's a fire sale auction, and the taxpayers are the ones who end up getting the short end of the stick. I did
right.
Forget one thing, though. Medicaid expansion, do you take it, yes or no?
Yes.
Absolutely. Tom Wolf, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as the campaign heats up and as we get towards the May primary.
Thank you very much for having me, Rick. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Tom Wolf, Democratic gubernatorial candidate. Again, the website, wolfforpa.com. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Tom Wolf's name. Take you right there. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
In the movie plot of a spy thriller, our hero gets captured by agents of a repressive government, and they take him into a dark interrogation room where the sadistic spy master hisses at him, "We have ways of making you talk." Meanwhile, in real life, the director of our national security agency hisses at journalists, "We have ways of keeping you from talking." Well, not quite in those words, but General Keith Alexander, chief spook at NSA and head of U.S. Cyber Command, did reveal a chilling disrespect for our constitutional right to both free speech and a free press. In an October interview, he called for outlawing any reporting on his agency's secret program of spying on every American. "I think it's wrong that newspaper reporters have all these documents, giving them out as if these, you know, it just doesn't make any sense." Then came his spooky punchline. "We ought to come up with a way of stopping it. It's wrong to allow this to go on." Holy Thomas Paine! Spy on us, okay? Report on it, not. What country does this autocrat represent? Alexander's secret, indiscriminate supercomputer scooping up of data on every phone call, email, and other private business of every American is what doesn't make any sense. It's an Orwellian mass invasion of everyone's privacy, creating the kind of routine 24/7 surveillance state our government loudly deplores in China and Russia. And it amounts to stomping on our Fourth Amendment guarantee that we're to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. This is Jim Hightower saying that's the real outrage we should be stopping. But no, our constitutionally clueless spymaster doubles down on his dangerous ignorance by also stomping on the First Amendment. If this was a movie, people would laugh at it as being too far-fetched to believe. But there it is, horribly real.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
I'm proposing something we haven't had in a long time, a reality-based budget. The coolest thing in store, was the Commodore 64.
Well, that's kind of where he took the education budget for higher ed. You know, you look at the priorities of this governor, and it's just mind-boggling. It's not my priorities that I think I would want or any other working person in this Commonwealth. And that's why I'm hoping come November, we have someone new. And I like Tom Wolf. I think he's a great guy, a good businessman. He was a good Secretary of Revenue. And I hope you'll check out his website, wolfforpa.com. Look, at the end of it, I like the vast majority of the candidates on the Democratic side. I think all of them, virtually all of them, would be a better choice than the guy who right now is holding that office. And because, you know, I don't know that we would have a governor saying you're on your own. And I look at West Virginia right now where they got the Freedom Water. The governor basically said, well, if you drink the water, it's your decision. If you feel comfortable drinking the water, it's your decision. Scary, scary stuff. Anyway, our governor came out with his energy proposal. And to me, it looks like, you know, a 73-page kind of like a yellow pages of government programs and state resources for businesses. And hey, that's, I guess it's okay. I don't know that it's an energy plan so much. But, you know, it is what it is. He's come up with a plan, though. I understand on Thursday, though, the House Democratic Policy Committee is going to be holding a hearing on electric competition. I guess more deregulation costs, consumer choice, and electric default services, which is why we have asked Representative Peter Daly, the Democratic chairman of the House Consumer Affairs Committee, to come talk to us about the hearing and some other things. Representative, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
You know, I've been hearing these ads, and I've been, you know, seeing these all this stuff that says you got to make a choice, and if you don't, we're going to make a choice for you. And I'm going, well, what choice is that?
Well, I mean, by law, I mean, you really have the default service provider, like Duke Ellington, Energy, PPL. What the state wants to do is they want to make the choice. They want to give you possibly an electric generation supplier that's really kind of unregulated. But they're going to make about $150 for every consumer that they actually send off to this supplier.
Wow. So somebody's making money.
Well, the state's going to make a one-time probably about $150 million. That's a lot of money.
Could you make an argument that that's a tax?
You know what? I've been around 32 years in the legislature, and I never heard the song sung so proudly by the opposite party of mine that always said they're not going to tax anybody, but every time they do something, it looks like a tax, it quacks like a tax, it walks like a tax. I think it's a tax.
Because I'm looking at this, and, you know, I remember back in the 90s, and maybe I'm sure that you'll remember as well, when they were trying to get us to deregulate. And I remember the commercial like it was yesterday that, you know, the person's going up to heaven, and, you know, the guy asked at the pearly gates, I'd like to have this choice. And St. Peter goes, where do you think you are, Pennsylvania? And I'm going, what choice do I really have? I don't have any real choice. Come on. There's no real choice in our electric markets.
Well, there really isn't, but there's a lot of unregulated electric generation suppliers all over the country now. And like I said, they're unregulated. They're not controlled by the PUC. They're not regulated by the PUC. And, you know, our major problem is, you know, what this will be is a major deviation from what we've done. But we want to make sure that, you know, let's say your residents are getting affordable, reliable, and safe electricity, or whatever they may be getting, it has to be reliable.
Right.
And, you know, they've got to make sure it is.
Because I'm thinking California. I'm thinking Enron. I'm looking at the worst case scenarios of, you know, because understand, business is in business to make money, not to provide a service anymore. And I'm concerned we're the next California. There's the next Enron pops up. We end up in these situations where we're paying through the nose because, hey, it's the wild, wild west of electricity.
It is truly the wild, wild west of electricity.
So what are we doing? I mean, you know, I love this argument of competition, especially where there really isn't any push to us and rammed down our throats. What should we be doing? Where do you see this going?
Well, our policy committee is going to have an informational hearing on the whole electric competition, but this bill's in the Senate. It's the Senate Bill 1121 that's going to do this. It has to come to the House. It has to come to our committee. It comes to the House committee. We're going to have hearings on it. We're going to really kind of vet this as well as we can to make sure that, you know, the taxpayers aren't getting screwed in the process here.
So I want to go back to this default thing because I want people to have a crystal clear understanding of exactly what this means. If I don't check off on a box, and for me, for instance, I have solar panels, so I have to stay with PPL. I can't choose one of the other providers because of some weird contract that I ended up because of the state. And we'll get into that in a minute. But I can't choose anyone else. Am I one of the people that they're going to sell since I can't make a choice?
Yeah, right. They will. And about 40% of residential customers in Pennsylvania do shop for electricity, but 60% don't. And you're going to be one of those people who are going to be yanked up and you're going to be sold to somebody else.
And here's the thing that gets me. I've talked to several people who made their choice, and they've actually jumped a couple of times over the last couple of years for different. And it's not even really the providers, just the people who do the billing and the service calls and stuff. It's not actually the people who produce the electricity, is it?
No, it's really not.
And this is the thing that gets me. I mean, if we had multiple people who had multiple lines into your house and could do all that, it would make some sense, I guess. But we're talking about one generator and a bunch of people who are, I guess, doing service?
Right. I mean, fundamentally, that's what it is.
So then, you know, I look at this, you know, back as I did during the whole preaching towards deregulation. What's the end goal? And to me, the end goal is, how do we screw the people who are doing the jobs? How do we take money from the workers who are doing these jobs so that we can put money into the pockets of the CEOs and the company owners? That seems to me to be the end game in this, because one company's generating the electricity, correct?
Well, fundamentally, that is true. And I think what's really happening is, as the time has progressed on deregulation, a lot of the CEOs of people that don't really know, they spun off and created these little companies. And they became these generation suppliers, not providers, not producers, not manufacturers, they're suppliers. And they get a little food on out. Makes sense to them, make a lot of money. You have to be with the in crowd.
So what do we do? I think most people are at this point are just going, we're being bombarded in every direction. Every time we turn around, there's somebody trying to get into our pockets. What do we, the taxpayers, the bill payers, do?
I think you need to write your legislator and say you don't want it. And, you know, what we've seen is there's been a groundswell of support against this. And it's kind of invigorating to see the public rise up and say, hey, listen, this is bad, we don't want it. And they get really well educated, they're going to continue to fight it.
Let me ask you this, Representative Daley, because I'm a big fan of going back and undoing all of the insane deregulation we've done. For generations, we had good, reliable power at a reasonable price. There were people who would come to your house, service things. Things seemed to work really well until we decided that we bought into this deregulation mantra of, hey, we got to have competition where there really isn't any to be had. Why don't we see anyone pushing back saying, you know what, we've tried this. It's not working as well as we were told it was going to work. Because I remember being told, oh, your price is going to drop precipitously. Cut your bill in half. My bill has not been cut in half.
I think people short-term memory. They forget. All of a sudden they get lulled into a certain belief, and they get settled in the belief, and they just move forward. And, you know, eventually I hope that people rise up and say, hey, this is baloney. And we're getting shafted in the process.
Because, you know, I look at this, and it's really kind of a black eye on our government, who should be looking out for our needs. But I look constantly at what's coming out of Harrisburg, what's coming out of Washington, D.C., and it's not my interest. It's not my neighbor's interest. It's always the handful, the few, the powerful, the CEO, these lobbyists, these elites, who seem to have their interests much more front and center than mine or anyone else I know.
I agree with you. I think the hand of capitalism doesn't fit in the glove of democracy. It just doesn't work.
And what it means is we've got to start kicking people out.
I think we got to start really holding people accountable.
So you're going to have this hearing on Thursday. What do you expect to come out of this? What do you expect to be the result when you're done with this hearing on Thursday?
I think it's the beginning of the beginning here, at least in the House. We're going to have Energy Association, Retail Energy Suppliers Association, PUC, Consumer Advocate, the AARP. We're gonna start the process of uniting the public to get them incensed and let them understand what's going on.
Yeah, and I understand it's going to be this Thursday in the main Capitol building, room 418, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. This Thursday.
Great.
And anyone can come and show up and say they're there?
Yeah, absolutely. It's your building. It's your government.
Because I think, you know, I think what we need to be doing is we need to be going to these hearings. We need to be going to these and raising a stink and saying, hey, this isn't what we want for our commonwealth. This isn't what we want for our citizens and our friends and our neighbors and our families. This is a ripoff, in my view.
I agree.
It's just another one of those maddening moments. But Representative, I'm glad you took time for us. As this continues, we'd love to have you back again to talk about this, because this is one of those things that's just infuriating to me. And before I let you go, last thing, because since I've got you here, I've got to get through this. I got solar panels on my house. I know a lot of other people who did the same thing, thanks to the Sunshine Fund, thanks to the president, and some of the money that came into that to invest in alternative energy to help get us off the juice. Yet we've got a legislature here in our state that has destroyed the solar industry. How do we fix that? How do we? When I bought my solar panels, the SREC credits were $225 a credit. They're down to $10 right now.
Oh my! Well, I tell you what, give me a call in my office tomorrow and talk to Beth, and we'll look into it for you.
I appreciate it. Peter Daly, thanks for taking time for us. I look forward to talking to you again.
I'll see you.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox News seized on Colorado's legalization of recreational use and sale of marijuana to stoke fears, while offering no evidence, that low-income Americans could use food stamps to buy marijuana. This is how Fox & Friends co-host Brian Kilmeade introduced a recent segment.
I keep people collecting food stamps in Colorado add marijuana to their shopping list. Right now, the answer is yes.
Actually, the answer right now is no. In fact, food stamp recipients are barred from purchasing alcohol, tobacco, and other non-food items, including pot. In addition, food stamp recipients cannot use food stamps as cash or use SNAP debit cards at ATM machines. According to a study by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, fraud in the program is extremely rare, and noted that the food stamp debit cards actually reduce fraud further by monitoring transactions. Fox has routinely and shamelessly attempted to smear and mock low-income Americans, especially SNAP recipients, as lazy and parasitic, going so far as to actively lobby Congress to cut those benefits, cuts that passed the Republican-led House. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states filed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
How many people remember that? Do you remember the whole, it was late 90s. It was like 96, 97 when they were pushing that electricity deregulation. And I remember the ads. They were everywhere. Every time you turned on the radio, every time you turned on TV, man, there was, where do you think you are, Pennsylvania? And it was just obnoxious like that. Because, hey, we're going to have choice. Oh, we're going to be able to choose. And I remember going, what are we going to choose? One company makes the electricity. One company. Because there's one set of lines going into your house. There's one infrastructure. There aren't multiple lines going into the house. Sorry, that's not happening. And in fact, as a homeowner, I don't want multiple lines going into my house. I've got enough lines. So explain to me, how is this competition going to happen? Where's the competition if nobody's making it? Same person. Oh, we're going to have suppliers, and they're going to buy it, and then they're going to sell it to you cheaper than the guy over there. And how are they going to do that? Well, of course, they're going to cut their employees' wages, their benefits. gonna make them work bizarre hours. They'll figure it out. They're good capitalists. They'll figure it out. And what'd they do? And I remember saying back then, purely and simple, it's union busting. All of this competition sell-off, all the ass, it's union busting. It's what it was. Because the people who used to go out and do the line work, almost 100% of them were union members. Now, most of them are union members still, but they've got some, not so much. The people who are inside when you're dealing with the customer service, who knows now? Am I calling Bangladesh? Am I calling Bhopal? And at the end of it, you know, where did we save? Did we save anything? Because they keep going back to the PUC and say, hey, we need a raise. We need to raise the rates because we need this, that, or that. And they usually faithfully, okay. So where'd we benefit? What we actually did is we gave away the infrastructure. An infrastructure that our tax dollars built. And that's the thing that just infuriates me on all of these privatization schemes. It was our investment. And I look at where I live. I live just a little bit outside of town, kind of a little more rural area than the rural area of Carlisle, but a little more, you know, a little more out of town, where I doubt that without government investment, they would have ever bothered to put electricity. They would have ever bothered to put a phone. I look at how slow it is to get me high-speed internet. And you got to go, would they have done it without the public investment? And you look at our grid. I read something not too long ago that, you know, between two-thirds and 70% of two-thirds to 80% of the electricity is lost in transmission. We're losing tons of electricity because of our outdated infrastructure. And you go back to, you know, when Jerry Brown was governor running for president, the governor of California, when he was running for president years past. I think it was 88 that he was running. And one of the ideas he had was to, because we were in the middle of the, we were coming out of the Reagan recession. That's what it was. We're coming out of the Reagan recession. And he's like, we got to get people back to work. Let's rewire the country. Train electricians. I thought it had been a good idea. Anyway, let's take a quick break, back with hour two. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, Stitcher on the smartphone, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks for being here. We're right back. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Local Teamsters Union officials are taking a look at details of a restructuring agreement the union says will save more than 30,000 good American jobs. The Teamsters reached a tentative agreement with YRC Worldwide that, quote, provides a pathway for substantial debt reduction and refinancing initiatives, end quote, that the Teamsters say will permit the company to protect and preserve the jobs. An initial company offer was rejected January 9th in a vote by over 19,000 Teamsters members. If the Committee of Local Teamsters officials approve, the tentative agreement will be sent on then to the membership for a ratification vote. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says the union pushed to re-engage all stakeholders in YRC Worldwide to come up with an alternative solution that protects jobs. Wisconsin is marking the fourth anniversary of the Citizens United U.S. Supreme Court decision with a rally and press conference calling on the Wisconsin legislature to debate a resolution that would put the Citizens United question to the voters of Wisconsin in a statewide referendum. referendum. A Wisconsin coalition is backing the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. They want Wisconsin to join 16 other states and over 500 communities nationwide that are calling for a constitutional amendment overturning the decision that allows corporations unlimited spending in elections. Congressional Republicans continue to hold jobless Americans hostage to other demands they're making before they will agree to extend unemployment benefits. And the suffering of people who have been unemployed for a long time continues. Workers recently delivered petitions to GOP congressional leaders in Washington urging that the benefits be extended. On a recent press conference call organized by Americans United for Change, Candace Hemmerly, a Wisconsin worker unemployed for more than 6 months, tearfully called on Congress to extend the benefits.
I've depleted my retirement to keep my son in college. I have not had the courage to tell him that I'm out of work. I began collecting, I began collecting my unemployment in June, and it ended last week. I have no more unemployment. I was struggling to get by on the $363 a week I received each week, but I made it. Barely. I implore Congress to renew the federal unemployment insurance just to keep a roof over my head.
Alaska Airlines flight attendants are voting until February 14th on a new contract. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the new proposed deal includes top-of-the-industry improvements in many categories. 3,100 Alaska Airlines flight attendants are eligible to vote on the proposed new contract. The tentative agreement was reached between the union and Alaska Airlines with the help of the National Mediation Board.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. You may remember just before Christmas, the story in Bangladesh. You may remember the fire there, the Tazreen fashion factory fire that killed 112 workers. They actually charged a number of those, I guess 11 of them, 11 employees plus the two owners, charged them with homicide, culpable homicide. And you look at the factory collapse at the Rana Plaza that killed 1,132 workers, injuring more than 2,500. The owner there was arrested, his assets taken. But that's Bangladesh. Here in the U.S., I got to wonder. The collapse that happened yesterday in Omaha that took the lives of two workers, hospitalizing 10 others with serious injuries. You kind of got to wonder, anyone going to jail for that? I can almost guarantee, well, I can guarantee not. Even though OSHA was on site at the time of the collapse, and you look at the record, not very good. Records show that the plant owner, International Nutrition, was hit with half a dozen serious violations in 2012, including problems with wiring and safety equipment. Now, not surprisingly, the company declined any comment, because, as I've always said, if you want to kill somebody, just hire them. It is that simple. But, you know, to me, we've got to be talking more about what happens on the job, safety on the job. And it starts, in my view, with a voice on the job, which is why we've asked our good friend Abe Amoros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director for the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, to come talk to us. Abe, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Rick. Good to be with you.
You know, I look at this building collapse in Omaha, and, you know, two people lost their lives, 10 other folks seriously injured. And, you know, I always ask the question, okay, these things happened. Who's going to be held accountable?
Well, clearly the owner should be held accountable. And, I have to agree with you. I know that OSHA was on site, as well as representatives of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And I know that it is a hazardous place to work at. I mean, anytime you're working with combustible grain dust, I mean, something bad is bound to happen. But the fact that, like you said, they've been cited before and they have not been held accountable is absolutely reprehensible. Two people are dead. 10 people have been severely injured. And it's impacted the, 28 other employees as well, 26 other employees, rather. And it's just absolutely tragic that we're still dealing with these kinds of things in 2014. And you know, these corporations and these business owners, they have to be held accountable. for their workers. They have to provide the safest environment for them, or else tragedies such as this are going to continue happening.
Now, you know, the thing that gets me is corporations want to be people, but when it comes time to pay up like people, let's lock them up. Let's maybe give them to Texas and have them executed.
Yeah,
not so much.
You're right, Rick. I mean, it's a sad thing because safety is last in some of these corporations and businesses. They put profits and they put the bottom line ahead of the safety of their workers. And why is that? I mean, these are the people that are actually helping you contribute to that bottom line. They're the ones that are creating your profits, and they're the ones that are in the trenches doing all the dirty work. It just makes sense that you take care of them in the way of safety first, but that's just not the case. And shame on International Nutrition for not having been more careful, number one, and number two, for not having addressed some of the instances that they were flagged for. I mean, six things is a lot in 1 year in terms of safety violations, Rick.
Yeah, and especially given the understaffed nature of OSHA. I saw a statistic not too long ago said it would take OSHA 111 years to inspect every workplace in this country. That's how understaffed they are.
That's absolutely horrific. I mean, that is a story that should be plastered on every front page of every newspaper in America. I mean, when the federal government cannot handle the number of cases and violations, you know that's a problem. OSHA needs to be beefed up. Congress should get involved in this. And really, this should set off a firestorm, no pun intended, man, on you know, making sure that we have more people able to monitor these things, number one, but number two, address them. I mean, there's got to be enforcement. There's got to be teeth to something like this. There have to be violations and fines and penalties for irresponsible business owners such as International Nutrition.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, my view on it, I have a couple of different views, and I have a libertarian view that maybe we don't need the federal government. They can't, OSHA, 111 years, they're not going to get to every place. Maybe, you know, in the good American value of being having a libertarian streak, maybe we organize at the workplace, we gain a voice and say, you know what, that's not safe, we're not doing it.
That's right. It's got to start with the workers, but the workers also have to be given the latitude to organize and defend themselves and have those voices. And unscrupulous businesses such as International Nutrition suppress voices like that. And the workers have to start by stepping out of their comfort zone and saying, hey, man, this is wrong, and talking to other people and who agree that this is wrong and really addressing some of the things that need to be addressed on the workplace side. I mean, like you said, I mean, you know, I know it's tongue-in-cheek, but if you want to kill someone, hire them. I mean, it's a horrible thing. It's a horrible premise. You want to be able to take care of your family. You want to be able to come home in one piece at the end of the day. You don't have to worry about the explosions. You don't want to worry about faulty wiring that could set off a fire in a dilapidated building. And you certainly don't want to worry about the accumulation of combustible grain dust.
Right.
I mean, you want to be able to come home at the end of the day, provide for your family, you know, get up, repeat the cycle over and over again 5 days a week. But, I mean, this is just a sad thing. But it should be a wake-up call, Rick, and I hope that workers realize that their voices are important in these matters and they really need to speak up.
Well, you know, the thing is, I go back to when I was driving a truck for a living. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I was a member of the Teamsters, very proud member for 20 years. And, you know, I had the protection of a contract and a union that would back me up, that when I would go out and I would inspect the vehicle, if the brakes weren't right or if something wasn't right, I would go back and say, not right, you got to fix it. I was empowered at that moment to say, I'm not taking it to that next step where a catastrophe could happen.
That's exactly right. And empowered is the right word, because there is strength in numbers. There is strength in a collective bargaining agreement. And when you take legitimate grievances to the employer, they should be immediately addressed to your satisfaction as a worker. That's what it's there for. Those protections are fundamental in the workplace. But, again, they start with workers and they start with people talking and saying, hey, this is wrong. This needs to be fixed. That is unsafe. That is dangerous. And I don't want to be around it. It's got to start with the worker, Rick.
But instead of giving workers that kind of empowerment and that kind of a voice, we see this this well-funded, big-money campaign
right.
to take those rights away under the guise of you're going to have some freedom. And I point to this quote, and I don't know if you've seen it or not. The state senator and the co-chair of ALEC in Missouri, a guy named Ed Emery, he says, quote, one of the things that will be advocated by the unions is look at all these right-to-work states. Average wages all go down. He says, sure they do. Sure they go down. You have a whole lot more people working in those states, and they aren't necessarily working for $25 an hour. They couldn't get a job for $25 an hour, but they can at 20 because they're worth it, or 17 or 12 or so on. So all of a sudden you have a whole lot more people working, but you find... but you won't find in any of those states that those workers were employed, unionized, that their wages have gone down. And he promotes this idea that you have the freedom to work. And they're changing the language, Abe. He says, as we go forward in Missouri with promoting freedom to work, we need to be sure that people understand the difference between liberty and oppression. So taking your right to have a voice away, somehow you have the liberty to then die on the job.
It's unbelievable. They will stop at nothing with their cheap and fancy rhetoric to suppress workers, to drive down their wages, so their greedy corporate pals can keep putting money in their coffers to keep getting reelected over and over again. That's what this is all about, Rick. I mean, that corporate greed really goes hand in hand with many of the Republican voices out there, not all, but many of them, who simply don't care about workers. They don't care about their wages. They don't care about their health care benefits. All they care about are those dollars at the end of the day that go into very fat political action committees. Because, you know, the Republicans are good at starving government, wanting to starve government, and on the backs of working people. I mean, it's absolutely horrible what they're doing. And you know, it aggravates me to no end that they can even try to justify the premise of right to work, which is nothing more than a race to the bottom, stripping workers of their collective bargaining rights. And why would we in Pennsylvania want to join the economies of Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia? I mean, some of the poorest states in America are right to work states, and somehow they're supposed to be happy with getting $10 an hour with no health care benefits on construction jobs. I mean, it's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. When I visited some of those states, Rick, I mean, I just could not believe the anti-union animosity down there. It's like woven into their social fabric that unions are bad, when unions are the only ones that are looking out for the little guy and the last bastion of protection for middle-class families. I mean, the hate is palpable, and it starts with idiots like you just mentioned, who are irresponsible in their rhetoric, and they fan the flames and of division, and they just want to pit the haves versus the have-nots more and more, dig their heels in, and say unions are wrong. These union bosses are getting, hundreds of thousands of dollars. But what they're not talking about are those corporate fat cats who sit in their boardrooms. They cut 2,500 jobs, and they get a $5 million bonus on top of their $15 million salary. Yep. But nobody's out there talking about that. I saw an email from the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania trashing union bosses about 2 weeks ago that a good friend sent to me.
Yeah, I got it.
And you know what, Rick? I fired back, and I called them hypocrites, and I said that they were sloppy and they were selective, and, of course, I didn't hear back from them. But you know what? I mean, these guys will stop at nothing. I can't understand. I'll never understand this, Rick, how those states in the South that have so many poor people could possibly continue to vote Republican over and over again against their own economic interests. Right to work is against every worker's economic interest in Pennsylvania.
So let me ask you last line of questioning, because I'm hearing rumors that in the next few weeks it could rear its ugly head.
Yes.
What are you hearing?
I'm hearing, Rick, and I'm keeping both sets of fingers crossed. What I'm hearing is that there are 13 Republicans in the House who will not vote for it. We need 9. Of course, Governor Corbett could call these guys and gals in one at a time and promise them projects and jobs in their districts if they come along, because the governor has now become engaged thanks to a visit from one of the Koch brothers. And so, Rick, you know, I'm hopeful that this thing goes away. And the closer we get to February the 5th, the less likely we're going to be able to fight this back. But if we go past February the 5th and it goes into March, the chances are that many Republicans will breathe a sigh of relief and not have to worry about primary opposition so much. So we'll be able to peel more votes. But right now I'm being told that we have 13 no votes and we need 9 to stop this. So I'm hoping that's the case. But you never know, because the Corbett people are going to be out in full force promising these guys and gals jobs and projects in their districts, which could change their minds in a heartbeat. I mean, we saw this in privatization, Rick.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and it could happen again, and that's what concerns me. So the good fight continues. We keep meeting with legislators. Tomorrow I'm meeting with the chairman of the House Labor and Industry Committee, Mayor Scavello, in his district office, to tell him that this is wrong and it should not even come out of committee. And I know that he has interest because he's running for an open state Senate seat as well in Monroe County. So I'm going to put the pressure on him and say, hey, this is wrong. And if you push this out of committee, I'm going to remind a lot of people in your district that you did this.
And that's ultimately what it comes down to. We've got to be talking to our legislators
right. And
pushing them in the right direction, which is why today I was supposed to go meet with my legislator, Stephen Bloom, but he canceled.
Oh, gee.
Yeah.
And he conveniently used the weather, didn't he?
Yeah, it was snowing. But he did. The snow didn't hamper him from announcing his reelection campaign.
Oh, look at, well, you know, Rick, he has priorities, doesn't he?
Yeah, you got to prioritize. It just is what it is. But, Abe, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Anytime.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it, and I look forward to our next update. Thanks so much.
Sir.
Let's take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox News seized on Colorado's legalization of recreational use and sale of marijuana to stoke fears while offering no evidence that low-income Americans could use food stamps to buy marijuana. This is how Fox & Friends co-host Brian Kilmeade introduced a recent segment.
I kid people collecting food stamps in Colorado add marijuana to their shopping list? Right now, the answer is yes.
Actually, the answer right now is no. In fact, food stamp recipients are barred from purchasing alcohol, tobacco, and other non-food items, including pot. In addition, food stamp recipients cannot use food stamps as cash or use SNAP debit cards at ATM machines. According to a study by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, fraud in the program is extremely rare, and noted that the food stamp debit cards actually reduce fraud further by monitoring transactions. Fox has routinely and shamelessly attempted to smear and mock low-income Americans, especially SNAP recipients, as lazy and parasitic, going so far as to actively lobby Congress to cut those benefits, cuts that passed the Republican-led House. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
In the movie plot of a spy thriller, our hero gets captured by agents of a repressive government, and they take him into a dark interrogation room where the sadistic spy master hisses at him, "We have ways of making you talk." Meanwhile, in real life, the director of our national security agency hisses at journalists, "We have ways of keeping you from talking." Well, not quite in those words, but General Keith Alexander, chief spook at NSA and head of U.S. Cyber Command, did reveal a chilling disrespect for our constitutional right to both free speech and a free press. In an October interview, he called for outlawing any reporting on his agency's secret program of spying on every American. "I think it's wrong that newspaper reporters have all these documents, giving them out as if these, you know, it just doesn't make any sense." Then came his spooky punchline. "We ought to come up with a way of stopping it. It's wrong to allow this to go on." Holy Thomas Paine! Spy on us, okay? Report on it, not. What country does this autocrat represent?
Alexander's secret, indiscriminate supercomputer scooping up of data on every phone call, email, and other private business of every American is what doesn't make any sense. It's an Orwellian mass invasion of everyone's privacy, creating the kind of routine 24/7 surveillance state our government loudly deplores in China and Russia. And it amounts to stomping on our Fourth Amendment guarantee that we're to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. This is Jim Hightower saying that's the real outrage we should be stopping. But no, our constitutionally clueless spymaster doubles down on his dangerous ignorance by also stomping on the First Amendment. If this was a movie, people would laugh at it as being too far-fetched to believe. But there it is, horribly real. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
And Exxon, yeah, well, right there. Yeah, I have all my friends who go, "Oh, we're worried about one world government." I go, "What about the corporatocracy? What about these global corporations who control just about everything? What about them?" Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Look, I'm being very serious, and I think Abe hit on it. The next couple of weeks are very important on this insane agenda that the right and the right wing of this, the Republican Party, is pushing through, and funded by the Koch brothers, funded by Wall Street, funded by all these outside interests. Look, crazy is attacking on all fronts. Crazy is pushing their agenda on all fronts because they don't know how much longer they're going to be able to act crazy. Look, in November we end up with a Democratic governor. Crazy's off the table. Crazy's a non-starter. So maybe, and this is the number one reason that Corbett's got to go. Insanity stops. Then you start talking about how do we get things actually done. I look at this piece of legislation in Arizona. According to the Arizona Republic, Arizona Republican State Senator Steve Yarborough has introduced Senate Bill 1062, what he calls a modest clarification in the state's religious freedom law. The bill, according to the Arizona Republic, would expand those protected by the religious freedom law for religious assemblies and institutions to any individual, association, partnership, corporation, church, religious assembly or institution, estate, trust, foundation, or other legal entity who decides that they want to discriminate based on their religious beliefs. The bill would allow a local hotel owner to refuse to rent rooms to any LGBT person, would protect businesses who had a religious objection to hiring unmarried women. So women folk, that means you, or any other bizarre idea. The lawmaker insisted to the Arizona Republic that prohibited discrimination remains prohibited. He said, in no way does this bill allow discrimination of any kind. Except if you're gay, we're not going to let you rent a hotel room. Or if you're an unmarried woman, we're not going to give you a job. Or, you know, whoever knows whatever else is on their little pea brains. And I know that's Arizona, right? Oh, crazy can't happen here in Pennsylvania, right? Crazy can't happen here. We're a little more sane than out there in Arizona, right? Wrong. And you can thank Gordo for that. Representative Gordon Denlinger, he has almost the exact same piece of legislation. Gordo is circulating a memo asking people to sign on to his proposal that would protect the rights of private business owners who want to decline their goods or their services to anyone that violates their convictions. And I love the language he uses. He says, you know, anyone who offends their sincerely held belief. And I don't know what that means, but you kind of stop and think about it. It could be anything. I don't like people with nose rings. I don't like people with tattoos. I don't like people with red hair. I mean, just think of the insanity that could ensue. Now, it would, according to the Freedom of Conscience Amendment put forth by Gordo, it would allow employers, store owners, retailers, hotel managers, or others to deny jobs, groceries, homes, or rooms to anyone offending their sincerely held beliefs. Groceries! Think about this. You go to the grocery store. Sorry. We don't like your kind round here. No food for you. I mean, think of how insane this is. Now, I don't know how you would... I don't know how you define sincerely held beliefs. But you start and think about it. And, of course, Gordo says that this doesn't discriminate against anyone. Except for, you know, everyone, eventually. To me, this is just a breakdown of our society where we're going to end up into little clans or little tribes again. Dengler evidently acknowledged the fact that the scope of the amendment is fairly expansive, and the example that he gave of how it would work is if Granny had an apartment that she wanted to rent, and someone with a lifestyle arrangement that she didn't agree with, she wouldn't have to lease one. Now, Gordo says, you know, if it comes to retail sales, I'm not quite sure. I don't know what, but we'll figure it out. He says he admits he has a hard time defining the specifics. Do you know why he has a hard time defining the specifics? Because he didn't write it. This is more of that model legislation. Someone said, here, Gordo, you're a good Christian wacko. Hand this in. And Gordo said, okay, I'm going to put my name on it and hand it in. I mean, that's, if you can't explain what you have put forth, if you can't explain your amendment, what you did, look, I've never written anything that I couldn't explain to you. Because I wrote it. But Gordo says, I have to admit, I have a hard time defining the specifics. I have a hard time doing it. Now, here's the reality in this. Gordo says that he believes that we're sitting on the edge of possible persecution of conservative religious people in the country. Now, here's the thing that gets me. The Christian majority in this country feels persecuted, which is really just bizarre to me. You know, it's like the big kid in the room being angry because, you know, somebody stepped on his foot. It's like the kid when I was about 10. And the bully punched me in the head. And he punched me really hard. But I was smart enough to kind of put my head down, put my chin down, because you never want your chin up. And he punched me on the top of my head. And ended up breaking two of his fingers. He ran to the nun and said, I broke his hand. And I said, yeah, I broke his hand with my head. I'm not the one who hit him. He hit me. So it's kind of that. We've got the bully saying, well, these people that we want to bully, we have to have special protection from them. We want to beat them up. We want to abuse them. We want to do whatever we want to them, but we don't want them to have any recourse when we do. Is that insane? And when I threw this up to my wife, she goes, you know, I just read an article that said that, you know, who are the most judgmental people in the country? People who go to church, religious people. You know who are the least judgmental? The people sitting in tattoo parlors. I go, well, makes sense. Makes sense. Strange stuff. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Liz Rose from the Economic Policy Institute about the inequality wealth gap. Quick break, right back, stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we mend. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Local Teamsters Union officials are taking a look at details of a restructuring agreement the union says will save more than 30,000 good American jobs. The Teamsters reached a tentative agreement with YRC Worldwide that, quote, provides a pathway for substantial debt reduction and refinancing initiatives, end quote, that the Teamsters say will permit the company to protect and preserve the jobs. An initial company offer was rejected January 9th in a vote by over 19,000 Teamsters members. If the Committee of Local Teamsters officials approve, the tentative agreement will be sent on then to the membership for a ratification vote. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says the union pushed to reengage all stakeholders in YRC Worldwide to come up with an alternative solution that protects jobs. Wisconsin is marking the fourth anniversary of the Citizens United U.S. Supreme Court decision with a rally and press conference calling on the Wisconsin legislature to debate a resolution that would put the Citizens United question to the voters of Wisconsin in a statewide referendum. A Wisconsin coalition is backing the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. They want Wisconsin to join 16 other states and over 500 communities nationwide that are calling for a constitutional amendment overturning the decision that allows corporations unlimited spending in elections. Congressional Republicans continue to hold jobless Americans hostage to other demands they're making before they will agree to extend unemployment benefits, and the suffering of people who have been unemployed for a long time continues. Workers recently delivered petitions to GOP congressional leaders in Washington urging that the benefits be extended. On a recent press conference call organized by Americans United for Change, Candace Hemmerly, a Wisconsin worker unemployed for more than 6 months, tearfully called on Congress to extend the benefits.
I've depleted my retirement to keep my son in college. I have not had the courage to tell him that I'm out of work. I began collecting, collecting my unemployment in June, and it ended last week. I have no more unemployment. I was struggling to get by on the $363 a week I received each week, but I made it, barely. I implore Congress to renew the federal unemployment insurance just to keep a roof over my head.
Alaska Airlines flight attendants are voting until February 14th on a new contract. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the new proposed deal includes top-of-the-industry improvements in many categories. 3,100 Alaska Airlines flight attendants are eligible to vote on the proposed new contract. The tentative agreement was reached between the union and Alaska Airlines with the help of the National Mediation Board.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
American workers are multi-billionaires. Want to end Social Security and Medicare. While millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Can Main Street get a bailout? Tell the president our checks weren't mailed out. Tell the House of Representatives and Senate and whatever businesses got the stimulus and Senate. Now they getting record profits that's tripling with no limits. But they cutting jobs and unemployment benefits dependent. How we gonna live with no income coming in? And the little help we get is cut from the budget then.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, we've been hearing a lot lately about income inequality. And, you know, the right trying to do what they do, minimize, change the subject. And, you know, as I said earlier, you know, I'm watching this television program and they're saying, well, you know, the income inequality isn't as bad as people want to think it is because, you know, we've got these social safety net programs that we make sure that everyone gets something. And then the woman mentioned something about wealth and the guest said, whoa, 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 wealth's a whole nother thing. That's a huge, huge difference. The wealth in this country, and as I pointed out earlier, we're working harder and harder for just a few people, and that's a real problem. Which is why we've asked our good friend Liz Rose, Communication Director over at the Economic Policy Institute, epi.org, their website, come talk to us about this inequality, this divide, this gulf between the haves and the have-nots. Liz, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I look at this and, you know, the right wing of this country really, I should say the fake news on Fox and the business channels that keep trying to promote this. It's not as bad as you may think it is. And you know, the wealthy aren't as rich as you think they are. I look at it and say, you know, nonsense.
Well, it's interesting. interesting because I do think that, you know, inequality is not new. It's been around for some time. It is getting worse. And I think the fact that right-wingers are beginning to talk about it is actually a good thing. I mean, their solutions won't do anything, but it's gotten bad enough that even right-wingers who pretended, used to pretend there wasn't inequality, they have now, you know, they now, everybody knows there's inequality now. Everybody knows that CEOs are making 288 times what the average worker makes, right? So the worker to CEO ratio is 1 to 288. And so, you know, there is a huge problem. The biggest problem, actually, you know, it's funny that your friend brought up wages versus income. I mean, I think wages is where we all get really frustrated. You know, we all want a country where you go to work, you work hard, and you get a fair wage and you get ahead. And I think that's where this inequality issue comes in, where people are working hard and not getting ahead. And we need a system where if you work hard, you can make a living wage. Yeah, that's the country we all want.
Yeah, because we've been sold this bill of goods my entire life. If you work hard, you play by the rules, you're going to do just fine. But I know people who are working really hard, playing by the rules, and yet they keep falling further and further and further behind.
Yeah, because the system is rigged. So, you know, the system now is set up for the CEO of a big company, you know, let's just say a fast food company. You know, that person makes millions of dollars a year. And the people who are on the front lines working hard, you know, maybe double shifts every day, cannot even pay their rent. And I think, you know, we need what's happened. It's kind of hard to explain that in economists say that the wage setting mechanism is broken, which just means that employers have the upper hand in a way that they shouldn't. And it's really because there aren't enough jobs right now. And so that has set this whole chain of events, which has kept worker pay low. That and the fact that, you know, the system is rigged by wealthy moneyed interests.
Right. You know, it's interesting you brought up the jobs. You know, at the end of last year, I was looking toward the new year with a bit of optimism. I mean, there was some positive news, but it always seems that anytime there is some positive economic news, it's always threatened by congressional failure. And, you know, yes. I look back to the end of the new year going, okay, next year won't be so bad. The jobs picture looks like maybe possibly turning around. And you got Congress who won't extend unemployment benefits.
Yeah, I mean, it is what's really frustrating is that there is good news. I mean, the economy does seem to be moving a little bit. And Congress is intent to, like, stab us in the foot, right? I mean, unemployment benefits are a good example of that. Not only are you hurting individuals, I mean, there are many unemployed people who are out there looking for a job. The reason why they cannot find a job is because there are not enough jobs. You know, there's government data that comes out. It's called JOLTS, and it talks about, you know, job turnover rates. And we know that for every for every five people looking, there are three slots, right? So there are going to be people who, no matter how hard they look, are not going to find a job right now because the ratio is 3 to 5,
and
right?
They're just not there.
They are not there. So it is cruel for the individual to have people's unemployment insurance cut. On top of that, it's just stupid because if someone is unemployed and they can't, you know, get a cup of coffee, then, you know, what happens next is the person who works at the coffee shop gets laid off, right? That's what economists call a multiplier effect.
Right.
So, you know, the Economic Policy Institute where I worked, our economists ran the numbers, and it's something like 310,000 additional jobs will be lost if they don't reinstate people's unemployment insurance because it's just that much less money in the economy at a time when things are already pretty lean.
But isn't that what we've been doing really since, you know, the stimulus that everyone thinks was this big, huge number, where actually what we did is gave half of it away in tax breaks. That really wasn't direct spending and money into the economy so much. Hasn't that been the MO of the austerity crowd, especially those in the Republican Party?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at the, you know, unemployment numbers every month like we do at the Economic Policy Institute, you see that the public sector, so that's federal government workers, state government workers, local government workers, you know, cops, teachers, firefighters, that's been shrinking. So the private sector has been hiring more people, but they're not hiring enough people to make up for these austerity bozos, right? So they, you know, not only is our government not providing the services that we need, you know, better schools, bridges, you know, building infrastructure, all the things that we as a country need. We're not providing that, but we're also constricting the economy. We like to say the economy is like a wheelbarrow. You got to pick it up and push it.
Yeah.
It doesn't just go on its own.
No invisible hand in your world?
Not in my world, you know. I wish there was. It is not all bad news, though. I mean, you know, we don't want to be Debbie Downer about this economy. I mean, I think there are some hopeful signs. But we just don't want to forget about, you know, even when the economy does start to pick up, we don't want to forget about the pockets of people. You know, there are pockets of people who have been looking for a job so long that they're not even counted as looking anymore.
Right.
Right? We don't want to forget about the long-term unemployed. We don't want to forget about kids who've been working, you know, crappy jobs and unpaid internships. So even if the numbers get better, we do need to examine what's behind the numbers, and we need to decide what kind of country we really want to have.
And that's, for me, the question. You know, I've been reading a lot of reports here lately about, you know, in the next 20 to 30 years, half of all the jobs that we have now could be mechanized in the future. And that means you don't have those jobs. And then what does the employment picture look like in the future? I mean, there's a lot of things that I don't think our policymakers are even remotely considering, because I think they're still debating yesterday.
Well, I mean, it is honestly, that's the truth. It's very hard for Washington to keep up with today's technology, right? I mean, it's just not, it's, you know, the democracy was set up to move slowly. And so it's really hard to move at the lightning speed that technology moves. At the same time, I mean, the feeling of our labor economists at EPI is that you don't need to be afraid of technology. It's not the robots that are the problem, right? It is much less, you know, worried about technology, because workers are smart, workers can learn, workers can adapt to technology, and we have the best workers in the world here in the United States. We want to work hard. We want a chance to get ahead. So we are not afraid of technology. What we are afraid of is a system that allows employers to not treat their workers well. So, you know, we just want a situation where, you know, workers can get raises. I mean, wages have been flat for a really long time for everyone except the top dogs, the top executives and the top CEOs. I mean, we just want a system where if you work hard, you can move up.
Yeah.
You know.
Have you seen this new report that just came out today from this Oxfam group titled Working for a Few? Where they point out that half of the world's wealth is owned by 1% of the population, and they go down through all of the things. I mean, since the 1970s, of the 30 richest countries, 29 of them have cut taxes on the very well-to-do. And you know, just this downward spiral of creating this billionaire class at the expense of everyone else, and then hoarding money in tax shelters, basically saying what I've been saying on this program for years now. We've created this billionaire class that's been able to walk away and shirk their responsibility to this country while the rest of us, everybody else, struggles and suffers.
Yeah, I mean, I did see that Oxfam report. You know, everything Oxfam does is excellent, and this was excellent, and I think it's an important point. I think it's really important for people to realize it doesn't have to be this way.
Exactly.
You know, you deserve a raise. You deserve for your pay to go up. You know, if your CEO gets a raise, you should get a raise. So, I mean, I think that Oxfam's point is that unless people demand change, nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
You know, so when Congress starts talking about something like a territorial tax system, which would favor the billionaires and, you know, screw the working person, then people need to stand up and say no.
Yeah, I don't know when I can when I'll have enough money to be able to take advantage of a Cayman bank account, or if I could even afford it. Most of us, we can't.
Right. No, but I did see Oxfam's report. I'm really glad you brought it up. I thought they did a great job with it, and I would recommend anyone interested to go look at it.
I mean, the title. I mean, you should have to read the title to understand. Working for the Few. I mean, the rest of us are working to create this. And this is nothing new. This has been the, you know, the history of civilization, where the masses, you know, work for the kings and the aristocracy. But in this country, we're told we don't have that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what happens is people just sort of, you know, a lot of people aren't interested in these wonky policy issues, and they just want to go to work and work hard and come home and relax. And I totally understand that. I really get that. But what happens is we have, you know, there's a system set up to benefit the rich. And unless we pay attention, unless we vote, unless we participate, nothing is going to change.
I'm right there with you. But, you know, you just look at the numbers, and, you know, you look at that, and it's not even the 1% so much. It's that percentage of 1%. And
it is frustrating. And I mean, you know, when I know we've talked about this on this show before, but you know, when you get back to the Walmart workers, right, where the, you know, this isn't even Sam Walton, right? It's just the Walmart's kids. So these guys did nothing. They get handed this huge company. They, you know, they never have to work a day in their lives. And then what do they want to do? They won't even pay workers a decent living wage when they have, you know, the percentage of wealth that this family has is ridiculous. And I do think we need to not take that kind of abuse anymore. It's ridiculous.
I'm right there with you.
Companies that want to pay people nothing, and then, you know, their workers have to get, have to get safety net programs like welfare and, you know, food stamps.
Now, what would you say to the right winger who would tell me, and I've had these conversations in the past, there are some very libertarian-minded folks that I know who say, well, we shouldn't have those social safety net programs so that people would then be desperate enough that they would eventually at some point, maybe just before starvation, they would demand higher wages and begin to organize.
I'll tell you what I would say. I would say that this is a great, wealthy country and that we shouldn't have people here who go hungry, and we shouldn't have people here, you know, who don't have the basics. And so I believe in those safety net programs. Conservatives make a compelling case, you know, when you go into neighborhoods and there's, you know, third generation of people, you know, on social service programs, and they don't have a chance to work hard and move up. I mean, you know, the system is not a perfect system. And I understand that they're, you know, I believe in work. I think there's great dignity in work. I think in an ideal world, if you couldn't get a job, you could go to, like, the WPA and get a government job. I mean, I really, you know, I think work is good for people. And I you know, I'm pro-work. You know, I think most people would much rather work than get a handout. So I
agree.
Don't think anybody wants to be in these programs. But for people who cannot get a job, or, you know, for people who can't function for one reason or another, I personally think that our country is wealthy enough that we can afford safety net programs, and they're morally the right thing to do. I don't want to live in a country with people starving in the streets like, you know, India or something like that. That's not what I want America to be.
And it's interesting you bring up India because, you know, in that report, the Axiom report, you know, they said that in India, you know, the Gulf is growing wider faster. And I forget the number that they threw out. It was, I think they had like 2 or 3 billionaires at one point just a couple of years ago. And then bang, all of a sudden they've got, you know, a bunch of them that, they got like 61. I think their billionaires went from less than 6 to 61 in just the past 10 years. And you've seen this growth of this wealth class while the rest of the people in the country, the 1.2 billion people in the country, they're struggling to just to make ends meet, just to get through the day, let alone make ends meet.
Yeah. And I think when you have governments, whether it's India's or like in Mexico, where the government lets people be taken advantage of by these billionaires. You know, so if in Mexico, if you want to get a phone and you pay, you know, the richest billionaire in the world lives in Mexico and has a phone company, right? And I think, you know, we want our government to protect us. There's been this very sort of anti-government mentality in the United States where, you know, if you poll people, they don't like government, they don't like infrastructure, they don't want public investments. But I think we need to turn that around because, you know, personally, I want a government that protects me. I want a government that, you know, a lot of Americans don't want to read the fine print, right?
Right.
You know, everybody makes it sound like people want choice. But I want a government that protects me against companies that tend to be predatory.
Exploitation, absolutely. And when you look at, and I go back to this report because I think it's important, that they pointed out that, you know, the very well-to-do in this world, that billionaire class, not even millionaires, it's the billionaire class, and the corporations hide some $21 trillion in wealth all around the world. And that's, you know, as they point out, that's in excess, well in excess of our entire GDP that's being hidden from productive use or from taxation. And to me, it comes back to we have to have a rational tax code, not just here in the U.S., but globally.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think that is an area where Americans are moving toward the progressive argument. I mean, there's no reason in the world not to have wealthy, super wealthy people be taxed and pay their fair share. And I think we're winning public opinion on that. You know, people want fair taxation. The problem is now we have a political system rigged by wealthy people, so it's much harder to get Congress to act on it.
No, I've been saying I've been on the air 8 years now here, and I've been saying for 8 years we need to go back to the good old socialist days of Dwight David Eisenhower.
Right, exactly. That's true. But I think actually you're winning.
Well, it's only taken me 8 years to do it, though.
Yeah, good job.
So I get to take credit for that. All right, well.
I'll give it to you.
I might as well get something out of it. So,
yeah, exactly.
So as we move down the road, and you know, the hope is that, you know, there's a point at which people say, you know, there's enough of, there's only so much of you-know-what I'm willing to eat, and we fight back. And to me, that looks like people organizing not just into labor unions, but into maybe an alternative political party with and push the agenda to get Republicans or Democrats to go in the right direction.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I feel like something is happening. You know, I don't know if you've seen their bumper stickers, the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like there are some. You know, I guess it doesn't matter if they're younger, but you know, some very vibrant leaders like Keith Ellison and Elizabeth Warren, who are shaking things up. You know, they are demanding change. So I think it's pretty exciting. I do think one problem, kind of sad, some really wonderful stalwart lefties like Senator Tom Harkin and Congressman George Miller are retiring.
Right.
And, you know, I can imagine being a liberal Democrat in the House of Representatives these days must be really depressing. Probably not a super fun job, and I'd probably want to retire too. You know what I mean? So I'm not being judgy about it. But I do think, you know, we need strong leaders like Elizabeth Warren and Keith Ellison, but we, you know, we're going to need to replace the people who are moving on and make sure that we have, you know, strong progressives there too.
Yeah, and not just at the federal level. I mean, on the state level as well. Which is why
state level, local level. I mean, it makes a really big difference. I live in D.C. In our neighboring state of Maryland, you know, just some local progressives there have made a huge difference on every single issue. I mean, it's really exciting.
And that's why just getting involved, getting activated, getting engaged, that's why it's so very important that happens. Liz, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you so much. Great talking to you.
All righty. Liz Rose, Communication Director over at the Economic Policy Institute. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk. They saw the food was everything to man. Maybe then they had a thought to help the poorest folks, but it only brought more money in their hands. And the poor kids getting poorer, it's a turn away, not able to admit the way they planned. Taking all the soul away from everything they grew.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
In the movie plot of a spy thriller, our hero gets captured by agents of a repressive government, and they take him into a dark interrogation room where the sadistic spy master hisses at him, "We have ways of making you talk." Meanwhile, in real life, the director of our national security agency hisses at journalists, "We have ways of keeping you from talking." Well, not quite in those words, but General Keith Alexander, chief spook at NSA and head of U.S. Cyber Command, did reveal a chilling disrespect for our constitutional right to both free speech and a free press. In an October interview, he called for outlawing any reporting on his agency's secret program of spying on every American. "I think it's wrong that newspaper reporters have all these documents, giving them out as if these, you know, it just doesn't make any sense." Then came his spooky punchline. "We ought to come up with a way of stopping it. It's wrong to allow this to go on." Holy Thomas Paine! Spy on us, okay? Report on it, not. What country does this autocrat represent? Alexander's secret, indiscriminate supercomputer scooping up of data on every phone call, email, and other private business of every American is what doesn't make any sense. It's an Orwellian mass invasion of everyone's privacy, creating the kind of routine 24/7 surveillance state our government loudly deplores in China and Russia. And it amounts to stomping on our Fourth Amendment guarantee that we're to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. This is Jim Hightower saying that's the real outrage we should be stopping. But no, our constitutionally clueless spymaster doubles down on his dangerous ignorance by also stomping on the First Amendment. If this was a movie, people would laugh at it as being too far-fetched to believe. But there it is, horribly real. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And finally, we don't have unions in South Carolina. I wear heels, and it's not for a fashion statement. It's because we kick, and we kick those unions hard, and they will not step foot in the state of South Carolina.
Yeah, well, if the Republicans here in Pennsylvania have their way, we'll be like South Carolina, and workers won't have rights, and we won't have decent-paying jobs. Yeah, we'll be just like them. Yeah, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Is that really something you want to be proud of? The fact that you've got one of the higher unemployment rates in the country, one of the highest poverty rates in the country. Is that something to really be proud of? The one thing that could have raised the conditions, the one thing that could have helped people move forward, you have said, I'm going to kick them out. Does that make sense? Jeez. Anyway, during that segment, we talked a little bit about the Work for a Few report out by Oxfam. And, you know, there are a couple of key things that I really quick in this hour wanted to hit. For instance, you know, a couple of the key findings, half of the world's wealth owned by 1% of the population. Half of the world's wealth. Since the late 70s in 29 of 30 countries. Tax rates have fallen, which means not only are the very well-to-do doing so much better, they're paying less than they ever have. You look at the numbers that I pointed out with Liz. You know, you've got this wealth class and these big multinational corporations that are hiding some $21 trillion in wealth in all of these tax havens around the world. And we've got Republicans in the House and Senate who want to give them an even bigger tax haven with this territorial nonsense. You look at these global corporations who, you know, look at Africa, for instance. One of the place in the world that they avoid paying the taxes at the most with the highest poverty rate. And you go back to what I've been saying, you know, for the last couple of years. Here in the U.S. since the recession ended, or so they say, our top 1%ers, they captured 95% of all growth. And the bottom 90% of us, that means all of us, we actually got poorer. Let that sink in for a second. You have these handful. And this isn't about being jealous. This isn't about class envy. This is about being rational and thinking, wait a second. We do all this work. We bust our behinds. We play by the rules. Yet not sharing in the rewards. You know, when I read my kids' books, you know, the one book about baking bread. Who wants to help bake bread? Nobody wants to help. Nobody gets to eat it. But how would you feel if you baked it and you didn't get any of it? That's where we are. That simple. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Local Teamsters Union officials are taking a look at details of a restructuring agreement the union says will save more than 30,000 good American jobs. The Teamsters reached a tentative agreement with YRC Worldwide that, quote, provides a pathway for substantial debt reduction and refinancing initiatives, end quote, that the Teamsters say will permit the company to protect and preserve the jobs.
An initial company offer was rejected January 9th in a vote by over 19,000 Teamsters members. If the Committee of Local Teamsters officials approve, the tentative agreement will be sent on then to the membership for a ratification vote. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says the union pushed to re-engage all stakeholders in YRC Worldwide to come up with an alternative solution that protects jobs. Wisconsin is marking the fourth anniversary of the Citizens United U.S. Supreme Court decision with a rally and press conference calling on the Wisconsin legislature to debate a resolution that would put the Citizens United question to the voters of Wisconsin in a statewide referendum. A Wisconsin coalition is backing the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. They want Wisconsin to join 16 other states and over 500 communities nationwide that are calling for a constitutional amendment overturning the decision that allows corporations unlimited spending in elections. Congressional Republicans continue to hold jobless Americans hostage to other demands they're making before they will agree to extend unemployment benefits, and the suffering of people who have been unemployed for a long time continues. Workers recently delivered petitions to GOP congressional leaders in Washington urging that the benefits be extended. On a recent press conference call organized by Americans United for Change, Candace Hammerly, a Wisconsin worker unemployed for more than 6 months, tearfully called on Congress to extend the benefits.
I've depleted my retirement to keep my son in college. I have not had the courage to tell him that I'm out of work. I've been collecting. I'm so sorry. I began collecting my unemployment in June, and it ended last week. I have no more unemployment. I was struggling to get by on the $363 a week I received each week, but I made it barely. I implore Congress to renew the federal unemployment insurance just to keep a roof over my head.
Alaska Airlines flight attendants are voting until February 14th on a new contract. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the new proposed deal includes top-of-the-industry improvements in many categories. 3,100 Alaska Airlines flight attendants are eligible to vote on the proposed new contract. The tentative agreement was reached between the union and Alaska Airlines with the help of the National Mediation Board.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So I came across this article yesterday about this photograph, this Lewis Hine photograph from 1908 that no one ever knew who the girl in the photograph was. It was one of those things that was just identified as, you know, the spinner, I think it was what it was. I think they've identified this woman as Layla Blanton, this girl who, you know, for generations, you know, 100-plus years, was just, you know, not even really a real person, but was the, you know, kind of the basis of the whole fight over child labor. Some of these photos that he took as part of the fight against child labor. And, you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, we think that we have done away with child labor in this world. I think it's been abolished. And the sad reality is it's just simply been outsourced to places that aren't in our backyard, kind of an out of sight, out of mind thing. And I look at what's going on in places like Bangladesh and places like Cambodia, and you got to wonder what's going on, which is why we've asked Ann Elizabeth Moore, a cultural critic, to come talk to us about her return from Cambodia. Ann, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, absolutely.
What made you go to Cambodia?
I've been doing work in Cambodia for the last 6 years, actually, around young women's issues in particular. Particularly, I've been focusing on freedom of expression issues, and I've been doing sort of a zine-making self-publishing project with young women there for the entire 6 years that I've been there. But about halfway through the time that I started spending there, I got sucked up into hanging out with garment workers and doing a lot of reporting for truthout.org on the garment industry there. And so this last time that I was there, everything went sort of crazy in that industry. So
as in most of the garment industry around the world, as we've shifted from here to other places around the world, we find these horrible, deplorable working conditions, things that I don't even think the average American can even fathom, let alone comprehend when they see it.
Yeah, Cambodia is in a little bit of a different situation there because it got into the industry so very late in the mid-1990s after the term sweatshop had already been sort of warped into the American consciousness. And so actually the industry in Cambodia was sort of set up around this idea of avoiding sweatshops. But since that happened, things have really deteriorated quite a bit. And essentially what was going on was that what used to be maybe a fair-ish wage, or like moving toward a fair wage, or at least a decent wage for the garment industry overall, those wages haven't necessarily been raised over the years. And right. So now there's a big disparity between what people are being paid and what it takes to survive on.
Well, let me ask you this. What is a reasonable wage? What would be a reasonable wage, and what are they making today?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the big fight is about, in fact, which is that, you know, in most countries, there is at least this concept of a minimum wage. And in Cambodia, that concept is limited exclusively to the garment industry. There aren't any other minimum wages. There are sort of standard wages, but the notion of a federally mandated minimum wage doesn't exist anywhere else. And so, you know, it really is a lot of what the notion of the economy is set up on. And in Cambodia, that minimum wage in the garment industry is $80 a month. You can earn more than that if you work overtime and on weekends and whatnot. But really, you know, $80 a month is your base pay. And the last living wage study that was done in Cambodia wasn't done since 2009. And that predicted a living wage of between $90 at a minimum and then $120 at the top. I recently did some math that sort of parsed out what cost of living increases might be. Again, for the piece on Truthout I wrote about the strikes. And what we have now is a situation where the minimum living wage is about $113 a month. And the maximum living wage, what it would take for a single garment worker to really cover all of her family's needs if she's the only one who has a job, of about $150 a month, which is, you know, almost twice as much as they're making now.
So they're in desperate straits, which is why they're angry and why they're out in the streets. And, you know, here the news that we see are, you know, all of these protests and all these folks out in the street. And earlier in the month, I understand that the military or the police killed three people in the streets. That's what we're seeing.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that. What's actually going on right now is entirely political at its base. There is a great deal of unrest in Cambodia around the recent general elections, which happened late August, early September. Things started to get sort of confused and frustrated around the notion of who had actually won the general election. The guy in charge, Hun Sen, the current prime minister, has been in power for 30 years. And he's, you know, his nickname is Strongman, and it's Strongman for a reason. And the reason is that he tends to use excessive force whenever he feels like it. And so this isn't the first time by any means that garment workers or protesters have been killed in government clashes or in military clashes. But it's also not the first time that people in Hun Sen sort of that are annoying the prime minister have suddenly not been alive anymore. And so what happened here was that there was a combination of a political uprising to actually sort of try to get Hun Sen out of office with the movement of the garment workers to actually raise their pay. And so what we had really was an opposition that was sort of testing his ability to withhold the use of excessive force against the prime minister's use of excessive force. And it really all came to a head on January 3rd when actually it was five garment workers that were shot in the street, although sources on the street told me that it was significantly more than that, and there are still people missing, and there was a lot of havoc. And,
yeah, I can't imagine from the video, from what I remember seeing of it, that there could only be just three or four or five. That, you know, the stories that I read, it had to be something much more significant than that.
A lot of red. Well, they did. You just start beating people left and right. So 47 people were injured, 23 arrested, I believe, on that day. 10 had been arrested the previous day. And then the 5 killed, and then at least 1 missing. But that's, you know, that's so far what's verified, which, you know, is enough to be frustrated with, I think.
Yeah, it is frustrating, but, you know, it all comes back down to this push and pull between capital and labor, the working class of the globe saying, you know what, we see these 85 people, I don't know if you saw the report out today from Oxfam, that 85 people control, I think, more wealth than 3.5 billion people in this country, or in this world. And, you know, I think people have just said, hey, enough, you know, we're working ourselves to the bone, we should be able to at least eat, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of it. There is, of course, an uprising around wage disparity around the world, and that, you know, it's about damn time. But on the other hand, what we also have are sort of savvy politicians who are taking advantage of that and trying to ride it to political power, and that's a little bit more gray area, you know? I think that's a little bit more about corralling people's anger toward your own ends, and that's a little bit more what was happening in Cambodia, and that's concerning.
Yeah. So what's going to happen now? What do you see happening in the near future? Is the U.S. doing anything? What can we as consumers do? Because at the end of it, aren't we the one buying all of the stuff that they're making? Shouldn't we have some ability to demand better for them?
Yeah. I mean, I there's a couple things that we can do. And the, you know, Cambodian activists are being very, very, very quick to get the information, to get the American public on board their cause. And I think actually one of the most important things that American consumers can do is actually really get to know actually what's going on in Cambodia right now, which does supply the U.S. 70% of what they export comes to the U.S. It's garments that they export. And it, you know, we do have sort of close ties to how their manufacturing industry works on one hand. On the other hand, there's a lot of this that's actually just Cambodia's sort of national policy shifting things up right now, questions about the economic future. I mean, the last 6 years in Cambodia, the last 6 years that I've been spending there have been just seen enormous booms in terms of the money and opportunities that people have, which is fantastic, but you know, they haven't quite figured out a way to let that money flow through the entire labor force yet.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of this that just isn't sort of America's problem. It would be great if we could support, for example, H&M and Adidas and Nike have all sort of said, like, hey, Cambodia, if you don't watch out, we might pull. And it's really important for Americans, I think, to say to H&M and Adidas and Nike, hey, we will support you if you stay in Cambodia and make sure that this gets fixed. But it's, you know, that's also a tricky proposition.
Yeah. I understand tomorrow is going to be the 10th anniversary of the assassination of one of the free trade union of workers of the Kingdom of Cambodia leaders, the 10th anniversary tomorrow.
Exactly. And there were just 11 more arrests today of various activists that have been involved in, you know, the whole plethora of movements, because the garment industry is big in Cambodia, but there's also illegal logging, land grabbing, all sorts of corruption issues that are going on. And so activists were trying to deliver and 11 of them were arrested, probably because tomorrow is the 10th anniversary of the murder of Chia Vichia, who's a very beloved labor leader, actually got, you know, many of the first raises in the garment industry in the first place and established the Free Trade Union of the Kingdom of Cambodia, and then sort of was murdered. And they arrested 2 guys on this very, you know, not holding a lot of water set of charges, and they were thrown in jail, and they sort of clearly didn't do it. And it's, you know, widely believed that the government was behind it. And tomorrow's the 10th anniversary, and people are really angry about it. Of course, they're still angry about it. And this is, again, the opposition party leader, Sam Rainsy, was working really closely with Chia Vichia at the time and helped him establish the Free Trade Union. And Chia Vichia was also a co-founder of the Sam Rainsy Party, which was the original political party that Sam Rainsy was involved in before he started running the current CNRP, Cambodian National Rescue Party. The opposition is potentially using this as an organizing force. Hopefully is aiming to do this safely and is being really, really forward thinking and concerned, you know, further damage to right. the garment workers.
You know, I look at this and you know, you see these stories and you see the countries that we have all these trade agreements with and how they treat union members and the union leaders. You know, and I think of the Colombian free trade agreement that we signed. And you know, here in this country, it seems like we're in such a hurry. You talk to people, and at their point, they've been given the unions as red meat for all of our problems. And you know, here you still, for the most part, have the ability to join and form unions without fear of being assassinated. I wonder, you know, I don't think it'll ever get to the point where we're in Cambodia, but you kind of got to wonder, though.
Well, actually, in Cambodia, it's much easier to join a union than it is here. Unions are quite plentiful, and part of this was because after the entire system was established, post sort of sweatshop activism in the U.S., joining a union was a legally guaranteed right of workers who were entering the workforce in the garment industry. But the problem in Cambodia is that the unions tend not to be very effective. In fact, there tend to be so many of them that you can join a couple, and they sort of don't really have the force to actually get very much done. And this is the reason that the anniversary of the death of Chia Vichia tomorrow is so important, was because he was a uniting force and he was very, very good at communicating with everyone and getting all the unions on board together. And there's a good chance that they're sort of figuring out how to do that again, and that tomorrow will be the start of a new way of organizing the garment workers as a united force.
So what should we look for tomorrow? What do you think is going to happen tomorrow? Anything
I didn't know people were going to start getting shot. I didn't know that people were going to, you know, join together in the largest mass protest in the history of the country. And really the country went from like incredible euphoria one day to absolute devastation the next day. And given those ups and downs, I'm not sure what to expect from tomorrow, but I would urge people to pay attention.
And we will most certainly do. Anne Elizabeth Moore, I appreciate you taking time for us and filling us in. I mean, I plead ignorant on this, and I generally am not, but I appreciate you giving me a little bit of information, a little education.
Absolutely. It was great.
Thanks so much. Appreciate the time. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You could always speak your mind. You work so hard to say what's right. I watch you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
In the movie plot of a spy thriller, our hero gets captured by agents of a repressive government, and they take him into a dark interrogation room where the sadistic spy master hisses at him, "We have ways of making you talk." Meanwhile, in real life, the director of our national security agency hisses at journalists, "We have ways of keeping you from talking." Well, not quite in those words, but General Keith Alexander, chief spook at NSA and head of U.S. Cyber Command, did reveal a chilling disrespect for our constitutional right to both free speech and a free press. In an October interview, he called for outlawing any reporting on his agency's secret program of spying on every American. "I think it's wrong that newspaper reporters have all these documents, giving them out as if these, you know, it just doesn't make any sense." Then came his spooky punchline. "We ought to come up with a way of stopping it. It's wrong to allow this to go on." Holy Thomas Paine. Spy on us, okay. Report on it, not. What country does this autocrat represent?
Alexander's secret, indiscriminate supercomputer scooping up of data on every phone call, email, and other private business of every American is what doesn't make any sense. It's an Orwellian mass invasion of everyone's privacy, creating the kind of routine 24/7 surveillance state our government loudly deplores in China and Russia. And it amounts to stomping on our Fourth Amendment guarantee that we're to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. This is Jim Hightower saying that's the real outrage we should be stopping. But no, our constitutionally clueless spymaster doubles down on his dangerous ignorance by also stomping on the First Amendment. If this was a movie, people would laugh at it as being too far-fetched to believe. But there it is, horribly real. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I tip my hat to the new Constitution. Think of five for the new revolution. Smart and free with the change all around. Think of my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees and pray.
Well, more fun with the GOP. This time in Michigan. The Oakland County executive, a guy named L. Brooks Patterson, he evidently did an interview with the New Yorker magazine. The title of the article, Drop Dead Detroit. What he says in the article, he said, anytime I talk about Detroit, I will not be positive. Therefore, I'm called a Detroit basher. Truth hurts, you know? Tough, you know what, he says. And in the article, he goes through and he says, you know, when I tell my kids, if you got to go through there, just don't stop. Go get gas here. Don't go there. Drive through because you're going to get carjacked. He has come up with the idea that they should put a big fence around the city of Detroit and turn it into an Indian reservation. You can't make this stuff up. And this is an elective county executive there in Oakland County, Michigan. Fence it and throw them some blankets and corn. Yeah. How about a casino? Wow. And this guy got elected. That's the scary. That's really the scary part. It shows just how far Michigan has gone off the deep end. And I guess what desperation will get you. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I got Jake on line one. How you doing tonight,
Jake? Hey, Rick, how you doing? You have to excuse me. I'm still chuckling on what you just said about Michigan. I think that guy maybe has potential to be governor up there. What do you think?
Well, he may have a chance to be a governor here. Look at the guy we got.
Oh, yeah. And I'm glad you brought that subject up. I quick want to cover just two issues quickly. Governor Corbett. I mean, wow. I mean, this guy, he just keeps putting his foot in his mouth. I understand last week, I believe it was Friday, he was scheduled to go to a school. I believe it was in southeast Pennsylvania, I believe.
Yeah, it was in Philadelphia,
and
Central High School.
Surprisingly, there was a group of people that found out and didn't like the fact that he had instituted some huge cuts, especially the first year in education. I think the amount was about $1 billion. That's some good change when you're talking about state government. Even here in Pennsylvania. And lo and behold, our courageous governor decided not to show up. And I saw the clip where the press cornered him. And one of the criticisms of him has been that he doesn't handle the press very well. He's from law enforcement. He doesn't like to be questioned. And you could almost see the pain in his face in the press. One of the reporters asked him, well, were you afraid of confrontation? He said, no, we confront our issues. We are not afraid of that. I just didn't want to inconvenience the students. Well, you know, I think that's kind of laughable. I could say to the governor, he better get used to it because there's a lot of people out here in Pennsylvania that have a lot of disagreements with this governor on a whole broad range of issues. And from now on into the election, he better get used to being confronted because he has a lot to answer for.
Now, let me ask you this, because were you surprised that he was willing to go to Central High School in the first place? Because the shock to me was that he would even consider, given his record, given what he has done to that school district and that school, massive cuts in funding to that school, massive loss of teachers and no librarians, none of that stuff. It was surprising to me that he would even suggest to go there, let alone bail on it. But were you surprised?
No, I'll tell you why. Because it's damage control, Rick, and I've been told that probably in the last 6 months he's gotten different people in. He's got people in his administration now that have gone through the wars, and I think they're advising him. You know, you got to step up. I think it's, again, damage control, and I think at least initially the thought was, well, you know, we got to go in there and confront. We got to spin it. Now, if you listen to the Republicans, and I'm sure you're aware of this, they're claiming that it wasn't a cut of $1 billion, that was just federal funds that dried up, and they're not responsible, and we know that's just hooey. He made a conscious decision to cut $1 billion from education, and it shows us, the taxpayers of Pennsylvania, his priorities, and he needs to answer for that.
I agree.
Now, the second issue is Martin Luther King. I found it kind of laughable. I don't know if you saw any of the reactions of the conservative talking heads. They gave Martin Luther King, you know, his dues. You know, great civil rights leader.
He was a good speaker. He spoke so well.
Oh, yeah. Well, me personally, honestly, Rick, I think he's the greatest speaker in my lifetime. I truly do believe that. I believe he was extremely influential in the 20th century, one of the most influential men in the 20th century. And to my mind, there have been some great speakers. But he's the best. He's absolutely the best in motivating and getting to the core of the issue. I mean, some of his speeches, wow. I mean, they literally bring tears to your eyes. But here's my point I want to make. You know, they conveniently forget that Martin Luther King not only was a great civil rights leader and he fought for human rights, he was also a strong advocate for workers' rights. And, in fact, as you know, his life was taken from him when he was down trying to help garbage workers down in Memphis in 68. He was assassinated and trying to help those ASPE members. And some of the talking heads were asking the question, well, you know, due to the fact that we have a black president, we have a black attorney general, would Martin Luther King be happy if he came back today?
No.
I think in many ways Martin Luther King would be appalled.
Yep.
I think with Martin Luther King, if he would come back and he'd realize the huge disparity of black individuals in our prisons, if he realized that there's the unequal distribution of wealth in this country and getting worse almost on a daily basis, the shrinking of the middle class, the stagnation of wages. I mean, he fought for working people, and during his time, unions were still strong, and he'd be appalled at the low number of union members in this country. They tax on workers, fewer and fewer people, controlling more and more of the. But I think he'd be heartbroken when he would realize that the U.S. Supreme Court. Took some key provisions out of the Voting Rights Act, which was his baby. It was passed in 94, and I think he'd also be heartbroken when he realized that throughout the country you have these governors and Republican legislators that have instituted voter suppression laws. I think in many ways he'd be appalled. But one of the things I deeply respect about him, as good as he was, and as good a leader as he was in the civil rights movement and helping working people and fighting for human dignity, there was a time, and it was probably the last several years, where he made a conscious decision to speak out against the Vietnam War, and I'm sure you're aware that he was given some advice not to do that. And he could have shrinked away from that, but I believe his place in history is solidified. I think he actually, Rick, became the conscience of this country. And I think even though he died in 68, never saw us get out of Vietnam, I think he played an important part of really educating the American people about how wrong our priorities were. And just to give you an idea of how bad our priorities were, I saw him it might have been one of his last speeches, and they played it the other night. And he made mention of the fact that there was a study done on the Vietnam War and how that impacted on our economy and how that impacted on our priorities. And he said the study came to the conclusion, and listen to these numbers, he said the study came to the conclusion that we were spending $322,000 for each dead soldier of the enemy that we killed. Wow. $322,000, while at the same time, in the war of poverty, we were only allocating $50 for each extremely poor American. And he was trying to point out that there's something inherently and morally wrong with that.
There is.
And I think his legacy will forever give him credit for that. The sad part about it is he was taken from us. He wasn't an older man, and it's a shame that the great man that he was, he could have done even greater things if he would have lived even longer.
You got to wonder how much throughout history, though, Jake, how much money we've spent on bombs and on guns and on warships. And you go back to Eisenhower's speech, you know, it's a theft from the people who work. It's a theft from the future of this country for every bomb and every gun and every missile and all of that stuff that we spend on.
Well, you know, when you think about the Iraq War, I mean, the misplaced priorities, I believe it was like Eisenhower said, every dollar that we spend in war, we take away from that hungry child, and we take away from education, and we take away from the future of this country and its children, and he was exactly right. But anyway, I wanted to call in and...
glad you did.
You know, I hope we never, ever forget how great a man, and he truly was. And here's another thing. He was demonized, if you remember, Hoover tried to...
Yeah, he had sex. Oh my goodness!
On him. But he truly loved this country, and he was a patriot. And I think we need to remember that.
I'm right there with you, Jake. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
All right, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show for working people.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Local Teamsters Union officials are taking a look at details of a restructuring agreement the union says will save more than 30,000 good American jobs. The Teamsters reached a tentative agreement with YRC Worldwide that, quote, provides a pathway for substantial debt reduction and refinancing initiatives, end quote, that the Teamsters say will permit the company to protect and preserve the jobs. An initial company offer was rejected January 9th in a vote by over 19,000 Teamsters members. If the Committee of Local Teamsters officials approve, the tentative agreement will be sent on then to the membership for a ratification vote. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says the union pushed to reengage all stakeholders in YRC Worldwide to come up with an alternative solution that protects jobs. Wisconsin is marking the fourth anniversary of the Citizens United U.S. Supreme Court decision with a rally and press conference calling on the Wisconsin legislature to debate a resolution that would put the Citizens United question to the voters of Wisconsin in a statewide referendum. A Wisconsin coalition is backing the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. They want Wisconsin to join 16 other states and over 500 communities nationwide that are calling for a constitutional amendment overturning the decision that allows corporations unlimited spending in elections. Congressional Republicans continue to hold jobless Americans hostage to other demands they're making before they will agree to extend unemployment benefits, and the suffering of people who have been unemployed for a long time continues. Workers recently delivered petitions to GOP congressional leaders in Washington urging that the benefits be extended. On a recent press conference call organized by Americans United for Change, Candace Hemmerly,
a Wisconsin worker unemployed for more than 6 months, tearfully called on Congress to extend the benefits.
I've depleted my retirement to keep my son in college. I have not had the courage to tell him that I'm out of work. I began collecting, I began collecting my unemployment in June, and it ended last week. I have no more unemployment. I was struggling to get by on the $363 a week I received each week, but I made it, barely. I implore Congress to renew the federal unemployment insurance just to keep a roof over my head.
Alaska Airlines flight attendants are voting until February 14th on a new contract. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the new proposed deal includes top-of-the-industry improvements in many categories. 3,100 Alaska Airlines flight attendants are eligible to vote on the proposed new contract. The tentative agreement was reached between the union and Alaska Airlines with the help of the National Mediation Board.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Sorry to break, I got an email from Joe. Joe says, have you seen the new Army rifle? Talking about the money that we've spent on armament, the money we spend on blowing things up, on destroying stuff. Instead, you know, maybe we should a couple of bucks to some, you know, helping, you know, people eat. Thought. He points out that the MXT-135 counter-deflate target engagement system has a range of roughly 7,800 feet. The email says it is being deployed in Afghanistan soon. It would call it the Equalizer. Some call it the Punisher. According to the email, the rifle's gun sight uses a laser range finder to determine the exact distance to the obstruction, after which the soldier can add or subtract up to 10 meters from that distance to enable the bullets to clear the barrier and explode above or beside the target. The email says soldiers will be able to use them to target snipers hidden in trenches rather than calling in airstrikes. The 35-millimeter round contains a chip that receives a radio signal from the gun sight as the precise distance of to the target. The project manager for the system, a guy named Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Lerner, he described the weapon as a game changer that other nations will try and copy. And this weapon, the Army plans to buy 42,500 of these MXT-135 rifles in this year, enough for every member of the infantry and special forces at a cost of almost $12,000 apiece. Lerner told Fox News, with this weapon system, we take away cover from the enemy targets forever. Tactics are going to have to be rewritten. The only thing we can see enemies being able to do is to run away. And, you know, he goes through this whole long line of list of, you know, how much the rounds cost and how much, you know, all of this stuff's going to cost. And they make a cost-saving argument because, hey, we're gonna save money by not having to shoot missiles in the air. And at the very end of the email, he says, you know, the most disturbing part of the email is in giant letters, "Go USA!" Like the best thing that we can possibly do is blow things up and kill people. It's just, you think about the money that we spend every year on making sure that we can blow stuff up, when, in fact, if we could just feed people, we would probably do a whole lot better. You know, I have a friend who, you know, a military mind, if you will, who says, you know, you look at Iraq, had we just dropped money, it would have been cheaper. Had we just dropped donuts or something, it would have been cheaper. And probably a whole lot more people on our side. And you look at the chaos that's, you know, the whole region. And forever, you're always picking the least of the bad options at the moment. And they always turn into the worst options in the end. You know, I often wonder if we spend as much time meddling in other people's affairs, if we spent that time and just concentrating on building the best nation in the world through education and healthcare and infrastructure and all of those things, and used our resources in a little wiser fashion, what probably a better world this would be. And, you know, I hate to go back and revisit history, but I often wonder, you know, if it's not for the election of 2000, if it's not for George Bush, if it's not for the political hacks that come into place, does 9/11 happen? Are we the world we are now in the post 9/11 world, which has now changed forever? The country that I grew up in, the country that I recognize, the freedoms, and I love these people like Gordo, Representative Denninger, saying, well, you know, I should have the freedom to deny those people a hotel room or deny those people groceries, when our actual freedoms are being taken away and our freedom of movement and all of that stuff is being monitored. And, you know, I look at Gordo's legislation as just another way to keep us at each other, so that we're not actually looking at where the real problems are. I mean, stop and think about this for a minute. In this country, I never, in a million years would have thought that we would be taking a massive leap backwards. There are actually legislators around this country, and not just one. I mean, you think, okay, Gordo's a wacko. Okay. But there are others who have introduced this kind of legislation that says, you know what? If you don't want to, you can discriminate against whoever you want. And, you know, the convenient argument is, if I don't want my employees to get birth control, I'm going to make sure that they don't. To me, the number one answer to that question, to that problem, is why in the name of anything would we want employers holding our health care? Why do I want a third party, like an employer, between me and my doctor? Get out of the whole mentality that, oh, the government's taken over it when we've created a private system. Get over that. This idea that the employer has some right, some say, in what you do in the privacy of your home, doesn't that scare you? I'm no longer worried about government being in my life. I'm not really worried about that. I'm worried about private for-profit interests. I carry this cell phone in my pocket. There's a window into my every movement. My cable TV, I find out that, you know what? They can track everything I watch. Does it not concern people? But all I hear is the dim-witted, puddle-brained, flag monkey nonsense that comes out of people like Gordo. I'm being persecuted because I'm a Christian. No, you're not, ding-dong. You're being persecuted because you're stupid. I mean, either that or really brilliant. I mean, because there's two sides to that coin. Either just a follower or really a very brilliant leader. Someone who has figured out how to manipulate the minions. How to go, this issue is important to a number of people in my district, and that's what they're going to vote on. Never mind that they're getting screwed because this governor has denied to take the Medicaid expansion money, which means that in his district, which has a fairly high poverty rate and a fairly high number of people who would need the Medicaid expansion, never mind that they're not going to get the health care that they need and deserve. No, it's about denying someone something else. And what is that about us? What is it about us that says, yeah, you know, never mind what I get for myself. Never mind that. I don't care about that, just as long as they don't get it. Seems kind of ridiculous, doesn't it? I mean, on a whole number of levels. And you look at this, the southern states, where you've got the reddest of the red areas, where you have really very high poverty rates, and they elect people that say, well, we don't want a social safety net. In fact, government's the reason that you're in poverty. Those, and I loved the argument. I was reading an article this morning that said the whole reason that wages have gone down is because of inflation. And their argument was wages really haven't gone down. They just haven't kept up with inflation, even though inflation has been fairly well kept in check. But they said, see, the housing market way up. You know, the cost of a house is really expensive. And we gave people money to go buy houses. As if. And they point at New York City, and they brought up the Jimmy McMillan, the Mr. The rent's too damn high, who I like. I think he's an interesting character. But they point to him and go, well, in New York City, rents are too high. There's a reason, and this is where basic economics comes into play. The reason is you've got millions of people and not enough properties for those people to stay in. So the basic general law of supply and demand comes into play. And this is where I agree with people who talk economics. There are some basic laws that are applied. If you have a scarcity of something, its value will be much higher. That's very basic. Even I can understand that. So to say that because property values in New York have gone up, and understand, they really haven't gone up in the working class neighborhoods, as I understand, as I've been told. Where they've skyrocketed is the very high-end apartments, the multi-million dollar apartments the Wall Street crowd gets, because their wealth has skyrocketed. And the demand for the very best, the best view and the biggest and the most amenities and all of that, there's competition for that. Because we've created this very elite small number of aristocracy, if you will. And like that report I talked a little bit earlier about, we've created these handful of mega millionaires, these billionaires. It's not even in millions anymore. We're talking billionaires. And I got to wonder at what point, you know, maybe sometime in my kid's life we'll start talking trillionaires. You know, because when I was a kid, the thought of a billionaire was completely out of the range of thought. Now we've got 1,000 of them. 1,100, I guess, in this country, right? And in fact, you know, everybody on the 400 over $1 billion. Kind of makes you wonder. If we're dividing up the pie, who's got the knife? Because it's definitely not you and me. And when I hear people say, well, you're talking about redistribution of wealth, you're damn right I am. When we've got people going hungry in this country, when we've got people who can't get health care, when we've got people who want a job and can't find a job, and you've got people sitting on stacks, trillions of dollars, because they don't like the black guy in the White House, or they want to be able to discriminate against you or me because they don't like the way you look. They don't like the baggy drawers. Like, I don't like the baggy drawers. Doesn't mean I wouldn't hire you. If you're good at what you do, you're good at what you do. Just amazing stuff. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox News seized on Colorado's legalization of recreational use and sale of marijuana to stoke fears while offering no evidence that low-income Americans could use food stamps to buy marijuana. This is how Fox & Friends co-host Brian Kilmeade introduced a recent segment.
I can people collecting food stamps in Colorado add marijuana to their shopping list? Right now, the answer is yes.
Actually, the answer right now is no. In fact, food stamp recipients are barred from purchasing alcohol, tobacco, and other non-food items, including pot. In addition, food stamp recipients cannot use food stamps as cash or use SNAP debit cards at ATM machines. According to a study by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, fraud in the program is extremely rare, and noted that the food stamp debit cards actually reduce fraud further by monitoring transactions. Fox has routinely and shamelessly attempted to smear and mock low-income Americans, especially SNAP recipients, as lazy and parasitic, going so far as to actively lobby Congress to cut those benefits, cuts that passed the Republican-led House. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
In the movie plot of a spy thriller, our hero gets captured by agents of a repressive government, and they take him into a dark interrogation room where the sadistic spy master hisses at him, "We have ways of making you talk." Meanwhile, in real life, the director of our national security agency hisses at journalists, "We have ways of keeping you from talking." Well, not quite in those words, but General Keith Alexander, chief spook at NSA and head of U.S. Cyber Command, did reveal a chilling disrespect for our constitutional right to both free speech and a free press. In an October interview, he called for outlawing any reporting on his agency's secret program of spying on every American. "I think it's wrong that newspaper reporters have all these documents, giving them out as if these, you know, it just doesn't make any sense." Then came his spooky punchline. "We ought to come up with a way of stopping it. It's wrong to allow this to go on." Holy Thomas Paine! Spy on us, okay? Report on it, not. What country does this autocrat represent? Alexander's secret, indiscriminate supercomputer scooping up of data on every phone call, email, and other private business of every American is what doesn't make any sense. It's an Orwellian mass invasion of everyone's privacy, creating the kind of routine 24/7 surveillance state our government loudly deplores in China and Russia. And it amounts to stomping on our Fourth Amendment guarantee that we're to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. This is Jim Hightower saying that's the real outrage we should be stopping. But no, our constitutionally clueless spymaster doubles down on his dangerous ignorance by also stomping on the First Amendment. If this was a movie, people would laugh at it as being too far-fetched to believe. But there it is, horribly real.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There was a controversial remark made by a member of your legal team comparing gay marriage to the union of 12-year-olds, saying both are illegal, which you called inappropriate.
It was an inappropriate analogy. You know, I think a much better analogy would have been brother and sister, don't you?
I don't know.
Well, we
know. I don't know.
Well, you know, we can, in the future, you know, we could just, you know, discriminate against them. We won't give you medical care. We won't let you buy groceries. We won't let you into the, we won't let you into our city limits, because eventually we'll corporatize all of the city limits, and they'll be run by people who have, what's the word? Insane thoughts. Always worried about others. This is what bothers me. There are people who tell me they're the high and mighty ones, the highest of religiosity. These are the folks who are always in other people's business. You know, as my grandfather said, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. Be a decent person yourself. Live the life you want to live. Live the life that you preach, and leave everybody else the hell alone. To me, that's kind of how I try and live my life. As long as you don't bug me, do what you got to do. I understand the Pope is going to meet with President Obama in March, and they're going to discuss the fight on poverty and inequality globally. That ought to be an interesting. I wish I could be a fly on the wall in that conversation. The president is going to visit Vatican City, whom he has praised as an eloquent spokesman on the scourge of inequality. And, you know, you think about over the last couple of weeks, you know, the president, have we given him a set? Because I'm not saying he grew a set. I'm saying we probably gave it to him. All of this talk of inequality, all of this talk of hey, I'm tired of working 40 hours a week and not being able to pay the bills. Has this given him some spine I hope so. Now, I look at this report that came out. And I'm going to talk about this for, you know, probably a couple days because I think it's important as soon as I finish digesting all of it. But I think it's important that you look at the distribution of wealth globally, not just here in the U.S. Because when I happened to watch this Bloomberg Business Channel that you know, they're asking this woman who's a Bloomberg economist about inequality. And they're trying to make the point that inequality isn't as bad as we think it is. It's not bad at all. And they have a nice chart that says, you know, when the recession hit, the wealthy people, they lost a third of their income. You know, the CEOs lost a third of their income because, you know, everything tanked. And if you looked at the graph that they used, even when they tanked, they were still in a whole different stratosphere. From the rest of us. Now, the rest of us, we kind of flatlined. You know, the upper middle class kind of went down. The middle class kind of stagnated. And actually, the poorer the country did just a smidge better because, oh, hey, by the way, we increased some of the food stamp programs. Look, when getting an extra $20 a week or a month in food stamps puts you into a positive trajectory, there's something wrong with the path that you were on. Just a thought. But they go to her and say, well, you know, income inequality isn't as bad. And she goes, yeah, that's true. And then the person brought up wealth. And she goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. Now, wealth is a whole nother ball of wax. That's a whole nother ball game. There are huge differences between those who have and those who don't. And you look at this report, which points out you got 85 people who have more wealth than half of the global population. That, to me, is just staggering. Just amazing. And they pointed out, you know, the country of India, where, you know, at one point they had less than 6 billionaires, and now they're, you know, they're up, you know, I think 61 was the number that they used of the number of billionaires there in India, and that the wealth, again, is being divided in a really screwed up fashion. And it comes back down to politics. All of this comes back down to government. And it, you know, when I went, you think about, you know, your high school government, your high school civics class, the first thing on page one, government decides who gets what. That's page one. That's where it starts right from the beginning. The laws, all of this stuff being passed, all of the decisions made by your representatives decides who gets what. It's how things are divvied up. And after World War II, we decided that, you know what, having this enormous, massive, hulky wealth class of a handful, the few, having so much was bad for democracy. It was bad for the nation. It was bad for competition. And we, the people, not politicians, and look, FDR gets a lot of credit, but at the end of the day, there were people marching and in the streets. There were people tearing this country from within, demanding. You know, I go back and you think about the Bonus Army that was crushed by Eisenhower and MacArthur for saying, you know what, we want our pensions from the First World War because we're starving. You think of all of the unemployed marches that happened across this country saying, we want jobs. You know, you think about it, that's coming. Last year we saw people in the streets. Last year we saw people demanding government action. It's going to be interesting to see where we go. Tomorrow we're going to be running a best-of program, traveling to Washington, D.C., for the Families USA Healthcare Conference, which will be there Thursday and Friday, talking about Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act and where we go from here, all that stuff, Medicaid expansion, lots of healthcare talk Thursday and Friday back in the studio Monday, where we'll pick it up from there. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.